Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
What do Nick DiPaolo, Haywood Banks, Doug Stanhope, and Rob Sherwood all have in common? They all perform at Wise Guys Comedy Club in Novi. Don't miss out on a good laugh. For tickets and to find out who's coming up next, go to wiseguyscomedy.net or call 248-919-3216.
Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the Sunday night broadcast of Night Call. Peter Werby here with you. Well, thank you, Jalene. Joining me is Jalene Jordan, and I hate to do something like that, actually, but Jalene was nice enough to get a cup of tea for me. Thank you. Your mic is open.
Well, and, hello.
Yeah, because usually, you know, I get it myself. You know, what is with, this is Windows Explorer's encountered a problem and needs to close.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. So don't you love when that happens?
Is everything going to crash here? Do I want to tell Microsoft about this problem? I'm going to say no. Because we're going to talk about the problems.
We have much bigger problems to talk about.
The world and the U.S. and Michigan and Detroit. A lot of problems there. So I'm going to say do not sin. Actually, we're going to talk about the economy. Every week we talk about the war in Iraq. And when people are getting killed, when our treasury is being drained, see, I'm off talking about it, aren't I? How can you not? I mean, that's if we, could you punch up that phone so people can call? We have them on hold for some reason. All right, you can call 313-298-WRIF. The phones are open.
We are ready.
Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, and here are the vitals. 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. If you'd like to email us, call talkyes@yahoo.com. My website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and created by Jalene Jordan, myspace.com, Night Call Detroit, right?
Yeah.
Now, do we want to still, you were...
My website, you know, it's been, my forum has been taken over by spammers. It has, yeah. But my MySpace is what I use, and I use that for my music and for my, you know, political musings.
It's MySpace.
MySpace.com/ Jalene Jordan Music.
Yeah, which is J-U-L-I-N-E, not Jillian.
Yeah.
That's right. A nice name.
It is.
But it's not Jillian.
I've answered to it many times.
Yeah, right. Okay, so, all right, this is one little thing which sort of ties into the idea about the economy. You know, some of this stuff, oh my Lord, I shouldn't say that, oh my Gaia.
Yeah, right.
Yes, the Earth goddess. This is February 26th, but it says Americans hate their jobs more than ever. Now, we don't hate our jobs, or...
No.
Well, you know, oh, I forgot his name.
I've had many jobs that I've hated.
Yes.
Many.
Studs Terkel. That's a weird old name. I mean, they wouldn't call anybody these days Studs, would they? But
maybe.
Studs Terkel is probably almost 90 years old, and he's written a lot of interesting books. And he wrote a book called Working. And at the beginning, he would interview people, and he would say to them, do you like your job? And they'd say, oh, I love my job. And then by the end of the interview, they're just complaining and complaining and complaining. You can call Al Slayer at 313-298-WRIF. I was just going to say, Al, pick up the damn phone. There you go.
Goes.
All right. He is the best. I was must have been doing something important like eating.
Well, yeah. Yeah. You know, the guy, Al, works like 14 hours on Sundays.
Yeah. So you MySpacers, get on this because this is all new to me, but it's MySpace. MySpace.com, Night Call Detroit.
Yeah, and you know what? To all of you who have sent messages, Doug Podell had me working hard this week.
He's our program director and midday guy here at WRIF.
And so I haven't had a lot of time to spend on the Night Call Detroit MySpace. I have posted your comments, but there's a lot of messages that I need to send back to people, and I promised that I would do that, and I will do that individually. I will answer you.
All right, here it is from LifeScience.com. Whatever the hell that is. Americans hate their jobs more than ever before in the past 20 years, with fewer than half saying they are satisfied. The trend is strongest among workers under the age of 25, less than 39% of whom are satisfied with their jobs. Workers 45 to 54 have the second lowest level of satisfaction, less than 45%. Older people like their jobs more.
They pick something that they want.
Is that us? I don't know. Let's see. Overall, dissatisfaction has spread among all workers, regardless of age, income, or residence. 20 years ago, the first time the survey was conducted, 61% of all Americans said they were satisfied with their jobs. And now, what did we just say?
It was very low.
Yeah. I can't remember the overall
figure. I'd be interested in what the Riff listeners think about their jobs.
You can either call in on that or in general, as you answer other questions or make other comments, you could comment on that as well. Americans hate their jobs more than ever. Well, it could be that Americans are getting less and less time off.
True.
That Americans get less vacation time than any working people in the Western world, in the industrialized world. That they don't, we don't get things like paid paternity leave, which is granted in the Scandinavian countries.
Denmark. My friend married a guy from Denmark.
Yeah.
And her husband, after she had her baby, had like 2 months off. She had at least three.
Well, if you think about these lying phonies who say they care about family values, they would put that into practice.
Wouldn't you think?
You wouldn't, yeah. But we know.
We know better.
Yeah. All right, the economy. Yeah. So nice.
Are you sure you want to go there?
Yeah.
All right.
Did you see this about the Ford CEO, what his pay was? $28 million for 4 months' work. Now, Ford posted a $12.7 billion net loss in 2006, but gave its new CEO, Alan Mulally. Is that how you say his name?
I believe it is. Mulally.
Yeah. You know, I just always read this. I don't hear it.
That's right.
I guess $28 million when you're... $12.7 billion, what the hell? But he was 4 months on the job, and the Ford pay package for Mulally comes on top of the $7.4 million that the aerospace company, Boeing, where he'd previously worked, paid for him for 8 months. So this guy got almost $35 million, more than $35 million, for last year. Life is sweet, isn't it?
Sure.
His base salary at Ford was $666,000.
Base salary.
$666,000, though.
Ooh.
What's up with that?
I don't know.
But they asked people in this poll on CNNMoney.com whether people thought it was appropriate or not. And 78% said it was inappropriate no matter what the circumstances were. So that's good.
Okay.
But I always wonder, who are the other 22%? What are they thinking? You know, these are the people that no matter what the circum when they were like peasants or something like that's good. I like, you know, that's good. It's okay.
Yeah,
you know,
going along
yeah,
with whatever.
Yeah, they don't care.
The sheeple. I call them the sheeple.
I think that is accurate. Well, I'm actually, maybe, I don't know, maybe someone can tell me, I have not really coined this phrase, peasantization. In other words, making us into peasants. Mm. Remember The Great Gatsby? A lot of these books people only read in high school, like 1984, one of our favorite books, that every once in a while I read it again, Orwell's incredibly prophetic book, and go, man, this guy was really tapped into modern society.
I didn't read that until after I met you.
Oh, well, then it's
a
different.
Great Gatsby was high school.
Great Gatsby, one of the things he offered to do, he lived in the Long Island community of what they called Great Egg, which was actually Great Neck, New York, which is a very wealthy suburb. And he offered that he would pay the taxes of the entire village if people would thatch their roofs.
Really?
Yeah, so, you know, like really like peasants.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. But here, this is Circuit. Is this the one I want? No. Well, this is good enough. Circuit City has laid off 3,400 people. Well, you know, there's been lots of layoffs. And
everywhere.
So the economy is getting stronger and stronger. Like Bushco is bragging about how he says here, White House says the economic surge, there's that word again, that began 5.5 years ago on President Bush's.
Oh, wow.
President Bush's watch is more robust than the much-touted expansion during the Clinton administration, which led Gene Sperling, who's the economic advisor to Hillary Clinton, to say that's absurd. But it is robust in terms of getting profit to Bush's main constituency, which is the upper 5%, in particular the upper 1%. But for most everybody else, things have been getting pretty dicey. Like, I was wondering, and this is another thing you can call and tell us about. One, do you hate your job or do you love your job? And because more Americans than ever, according to this poll, say they hate their jobs. But also whether you feel secure in your job. Because a lot of times when we talk about these mass layoffs and people losing their homes, probably, I mean, it's not happening to the majority of people. Majority of people aren't losing their homes. The majority of people aren't getting laid off. I mean, during the Depression in the 1930s, the majority of people were working. It wasn't like 70% of the people were unemployed. I forgot what it was, like 30% or something like that. But 30% unemployment is pretty, pretty terrible. But it was like, I don't think I'm going to get laid off. But I wouldn't say I feel 100% secure.
I mean, really... Who does? Who does?
Yeah.
Even a business owner. A business can go under.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But here, Circuit City laid off 3,400 people, and we know there's all this, what they call downsizing. Was there, I don't know, did Michael Moore do a movie called Downsize This? No.
I don't remember that.
I remember someone throwing the bird.
Super size me or whatever. That
but somewhere, someone there's a photograph of someone flipping the bird and saying, downsize this.
I missed that one.
313-298-WRIF is our phone number here in Detroit. Hey, welcome to everybody listening around the country and around the world, by the way, on WRIF.com and radiopower.org. And we want to send a special note of hello out to Shelby at radiopower.org, who is manning the barricades for free and independent online radio.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Thank
so,
you.
3,400 jobs are eliminated by Circuit City. Their jobs were eliminated solely because the company decided they were getting paid too much. That's why they laid them off. And I figure, how much could they be making as retail clerks? It wasn't like they're making like $100,000 a year.
Right, right. You know, and that this never happens. Just kidding.
Yeah. Well, clearly this article says, and it's just maybe I've got the article that I wanted, but let me see quicker. Well, all right. Clearly, the company doesn't value them as great assets. That's what it says on their website. Our associates, you know, they're not retail clerks or workers. They are associates, like at Walmart.
Yeah.
And it says, and the writer, and I thought this was in the New York Times. Maybe it was. Clearly,
USA Today, I think, is where this one came from.
It could be. Yes, you're right. It is. Clearly, the company doesn't value them as great assets. If it did, it would realize that firing employees because they're performed well enough to earn raises demoralizes everyone else. What kind of inducement is it for employees to work hard and excel if the reward might be a pink slip? And why would people want to shop at a store where the low premium on service is so loudly trumpeted?
Oh, there you go.
And they call it the race to the bottom. That's what's happening.
You know, and it's amazing to me that, some business owners, they expect their employees to actually, you know, respect them and want to do a good job for them when they're getting absolutely nothing, including benefits and things, you know, low pay, not even a living wage. It's extremely maddening.
Here in Detroit, we have casinos because this used to be the Motor City. Now it's like the Pizza City because all the big pizza owners are headquartered here. Domino's.
Oh, do you have to remind me of that man again?
Oh, you mean like
Monahan?
Yeah, Tom Monahan. Yeah. But to give you an idea of the economy here in Detroit, more than 26,000 people have applied for 1,000 jobs at the MGM Grand Detroit.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
Oh, my gosh. No.
26,000. And some of this I know is from a couple of weeks ago. A Republican congressman representing rural southern Michigan is taking heat for saying that most of Iraq is at least as under control as Detroit is.
Yeah, I saw that. That was a little bit of a...
Tim Walberg, Representative Tim Walberg.
Guffaw.
Yeah, and everybody got all upset, and Mark Allen, the mayor of Detroit's spokesman, said any reference to Detroit as a war zone is absurd. But the idea that we have cities in the United States that that people can even make that assertion, that they're either crime-ridden or so poverty-stricken in the wealthiest country in the world, in an economy that Bushco, the ruling racket, the government, the racket actually posing as a government, gives you an idea of where things are at here.
I thought he was being maybe possibly a little bit racist, too, as far as our diverse, you know.
Could be.
Population.
Could be. Houses in Detroit are cheaper than cars. That's an interesting...
Yeah, their house is going for under $30,000, I think, what I read in that article, that is what they're saying.
On the other hand, here is an interesting article, again, a couple of weeks ago, it was in the New York Times, is Doug Weintraub loves showing off his new $60,000 fireplace. It's in his backyard with a chimney built by a stonemason from Ukraine that stands 16 feet tall. Beneath the hearth is a cubby stocked with firewood. Just for looks, Mr. Weintraub says, as he pressed the on button of a remote control, a hissing sound could be heard. Then the gas-burning fireplace sprang to life, visible from the outside. He's a technology investor, and he cranked up the volume on the fireplace's built-in stereo system, and a meandering saxophone riff reverberated off his $2 million home and across the neighborhood. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
Mr. Weintraub says. Now, here, one more. The amenities and the costs grow apace in all this. A contractor in the San Francisco area, Tony Bertotti, built an $80,000 fireplace as the centerpiece of a $750,000 patio. Not house.
Oh, really?
That was recently named Best Landscape in the State by the California Landscape Contractors Association. Well, maybe all these people could, in fact, thatch their roofs, or we all should. For them, because this is the Great Gatsby. This is returning to like the Middle Ages. I mean, this is, and it goes on and on. State shutdown looms. Deficit, and this is in Michigan. Deficit may force service cuts, and they're talking about a $500 million shortfall in the Michigan budget, but it's like $2.1 billion in New Jersey. And people say, well, it's Governor Granholm and something like that. It's all over the country.
Yes.
And this again, Bushco, the racket, posing as a government, saying that what a robust economy is. Well, it's robust for all of his pals, the top 1%. The rest of us are just getting absolutely screwed. More?
You know, Peter, how you always say that people with so much money, so you know, when you get into the billions, how could you ever spend that much money? Now, look at that. Look at those fireplaces. You can spend. You can try really hard.
Stepping on a dream, Bob Herbert, the New York Times columnist, talks about, let me see here, one of the weirdest things at work these days is the fact that we're making it more difficult for American youngsters to afford college at a time when a college education is a virtual prerequisite for establishing and maintaining a middle-class standard of living. Now here, you want something really radical? Why isn't college free?
Isn't Jennifer Granholm trying to make college free in Michigan?
Oh, actually,
something
what's happening
about
in
that
no.
That. No, okay.
Sorry, it's the other way. A 40-year-old state scholarship program for private college students could be axed, putting the financial future of more than 40,000 recipients in limbo and stirring debate over whether the state should spend money on private education. But there's a $58 million scholarship fund that goes to, what do they call it? Not poor, but... low-income students. Low-income students that can attend any of 37 private Michigan colleges. Now, what if I said, "Well, we ought to charge for high school. If you can't afford to go to, if you can't pay to go to high school, well, then your education stops at middle school." We would say, "Well, are you out of your mind? Everybody knows that kindergarten through high school is free. It's state education." Paid by tax money. Well, why isn't college as well? If it's so important, if we want an educated population for both for jobs and for the development of the individual.
I think of my friends who have spent all this money going through college. I was fortunate enough that my father helped me. But for my friends who took out all of these loans and 25 years are still paying them off.
Yeah,
you know? No,
it's amazing. So, we have the wealthiest country in the world, and increasingly the middle class cannot afford the college tuition. And, if you want to go away to college, I mean, that's starting to be more than the median income of people. So it could cost you, like you go to U of M, I think it costs like about $30,000. And it's true worldwide. As Africa hungers, policy slows delivery of U.S. aid. And this showed, I was thinking about, I read this right after I went to Trader Joe's here in Detroit. I was picking up all this wine for the party you missed.
I did. I needed a night of rest, I'm telling you.
God, I knew the bride when she used to rock and roll. Who sang that?
I rock and rolled all week long. Oh, here you go again asking me that.
Edwards.
Okay, well, someone will know it.
Yeah. I knew the bride when she used to rock and roll. This, too, in America, tens of thousands of elderly Americans have received life-prolonging care as a result of long-term care policies with more than 8 million customers, yet thousands of policyholders say they've received only excuses about why insurers will not pay. Interviews by the New York Times and confidential depositions indicate that some long-term care insurers have developed procedures that make it difficult, if not impossible, for policyholders to get paid. A review of more than 400 of the thousands of grievances and lawsuits filed in recent years shows elderly policyholders confronting unnecessary delays and overwhelming bureaucracies. In California alone, nearly one in every four, 25% of long-term care claims were denied in 2005. So we have our seniors, the elderly, our fathers and mothers, our grandparents, being denied the care that they paid for.
It's absolutely criminal.
And what happens, Julene, when you delay these, like they say, okay, I'm claiming. You say, well, we can't claim. They die.
That's right.
Because they know, these son of a bitches, you pardon my language, because I'm sure it's daytime somewhere where you're listening, but I can't think of anything more awful than being done to, at some point in our lives, just like when we're babies and sometimes when we're elderly, we're helpless. And yeah. We're depending on a community in which we live. But that's not what it's set up for. It's set to rip out and squeeze out every dollar they can, and no matter who it is, whether it's kids in Africa or our elderly here in the United States, be damned.
They're just a number to these industries.
And these are the Bushes. This is what they represent. Lacking papers, citizens are cut from Medicaid. Same thing. New federal rule has shut out tens of thousands of United States citizens who have difficulty complying with requirements for Medicaid. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
And you know what? If you have good insurance, be very thankful for it. Yeah. Be very thankful.
Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan are here with you. 313-298-WRIF. Actually, we have lots of callers. What are we
sure
doing
do.
Time here? So, let me see. How do I push the buttons here from week to week? Let's see. Let's just go in order. Here's Lars in Madison Heights. Lars, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter and Jolene. Last week when you were talking about Blackwater, I was in the Marine Corps and actually know several people who have gone to work for Blackwater.
Wait a minute. Let's remind people who Blackwater is.
Oh, I think
is.
I got an email from you,
yeah.
Didn't I?
Blackwater is a firm of mercenaries. And which are now called contractors, and they provide soldiers for work
well,
in Iraq.
Protection as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, right. But go ahead. So when you were in the Marines, Lars?
Well, I knew several guys like who were, after they getting out, they were planning on joining Blackwater. I've actually seen them training because they were on a range before my platoon was scheduled to use it. So we sat there and watched them. They actually had better weapons than we did.
Yeah, well, it's run by this right-wing Christian conservative from Western Michigan, Eric Prince, who did a lot of major funding of the Bushco racket.
So they had better protection for themselves as well, right?
Seemed like their vests and helmets were probably equivalent to ours.
Okay.
It's just that they had M4s with silencers and some other, you know, high-speed accessories on them.
Is that a cat, or are you squeezing your baby?
It's a cat.
Oh, okay.
He's really needy in his old age.
No, the cat's mad, too. The cat's listening to the show.
All right, Lars, thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Brian. Brian's in E-Course. Welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to talk about how secure my job is.
Sure.
I actually work for a sub of Ford's. I paint gas tanks for their cars.
Okay.
And it's kind of weird because, like for the past maybe 6-7 months, I've been working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Wow.
You know, painting, you know, for the new, you know, Ford Edge, you know, the Escapes and, you know, the Mustangs and whatever. And it's just like I don't get how I could work that much if Ford is losing billions of dollars every quarter And I don't get how, you know what I mean, how I could, you know, how they can afford to pay me to paint all these gas tanks with, they're not even selling any cars, let alone.
Well, I know. Listen, their sales are down. I forgot what it dropped, like 7% in the last quarter. But always it's they find it more economical to work people overtime, even if they're paying them time and a half or even double time rather than taking on other employees. Because traditionally, when the UAW was not on such major such a major defensive mode, that they demanded that that everyone be hired in the auto industry before any or hired back before any overtime is granted. Now, I know a lot of men, some women, have made up towards like $90,000 a year. And if you're working, you know, 7-12s, well, for people not in this area, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. But still, that's so grueling. And people should not have to do that. I mean, the world has enough wealth and can produce enough that people, on one hand, don't have to live in poverty here or in the rest of the world, and people do not have to work that kind of hours. Again, family values. People shouldn't have to work more than 30 hours a week. Back, it was either in the 40s or maybe into the early 50s that one of the, this was not an official UAW slogan, but there was caucuses within the union that said we should be calling for 30 hours work for 40 hours pay. That over the generations, beginning from the 19th century, when the original capitalists were working everyone to death 13, 14 hours a day, little kids and no safety features or anything like that, that there was through struggle and blood and guts and strikes and everything under the sun, finally got it down to 8 hours. Well, the eight-hour movement started in the 1880s. Now, why the hell haven't we gotten it down even more? When we got the CEO of Ford making, what did we figure, $35 million a year? That's a question. That's a social and political question of how wealth is distributed in this country and in the world. It's maldistributed, so millions of people starve to death. So you got kids on the front page of the New York Times today showing they're eating a bowl of dry wheat, these little kids. Then you open it up, and always on page 3 in the top right-hand corner, there is the Tiffany's ad, so you can buy some earrings for $8,000. Now, there was a book a while ago that said, Everything I Know I Learned in Kindergarten, or something like that. And one of the things was, you can't have candy in class unless you can share with everyone.
Right.
So, I mean, it should be common sense that people can't buy $8,000 earrings until everyone is fed in the damn world. How the hell can you live? And I don't mean, I'm sure this kid in Dearborn would look at me or Jolene and probably not distinguish between the us and the $8,000 earring wearer or purchaser. But, I mean, as a society and as a world, I mean, how can we let this go on, I think, is the real question. All right, thank you. Thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Nick. Nick is calling from Toledo. Nick, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
All right, I have 2 points, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One, I have dual citizenship. I'm French and American citizen. And I've probably lived...
Nick, hold on. You must be on a cell phone because everything, either that or you were talking Venusian.
He said he's a French and American citizen.
Oh, okay. Well, then it's my hearing. I'm sorry.
All right.
Go ahead. French, yeah.
But you were speaking about Michigan trying to make college free.
Yeah.
And in Europe, or at least in France, college is free. You just have to pass the high school test.
Okay.
Which is a much harder test than, of course, I mean, you don't have to take a test to graduate in America. You just have to have a certain grade point average. But my point is that the people who don't pass the test, they're content with being a baker or working at a department store for the rest of their life, as long as they can just support their family.
Sure.
And in Toledo, I used to own a business for about 4 years, and we had about 8 workers. And, you know, if I couldn't give a guy hours, they were okay with it because they knew we were just trying to make enough money to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got the Circuit Cities and just about everything where, and back to the Tiffany's ad as well, a lot of Americans, they want to make as much money as possible.
Sure. The Circuit Cities, on one hand, run the small independent producer, the local shops, out of business. Then they bring in thousands of workers. I don't know how many people, employees they got worldwide, probably 25, 30,000. And then they start realizing they got them by the cojones. And they can, I'm sure, all the remaining employees at Circuit Cities are scared poopless. I would be if I was them, because they know the people there are ruthless. They don't care about them. They don't care about the families that these people support, and they don't care about the communities that that they live in and what happens to them economically. Yeah, I mean, under capitalism, yeah, people want to make as much money as they can. But I mean, what does that amount to? I'd like to make more money. If boss, if you're listening, pay me more, please. You know. But at a certain point, it becomes obscene, not just because it's ostentatious, because you're wearing $8,000 earrings, but because of the total maldistribution of wealth in this country and the world. People just like us, because everyone is just like us, are suffering badly. They're either directly, like we talk about. I mean, there's millions of people in this country that go to bed hungry. They're not starving, but they go to bed hungry. Millions of people go to bed hungry in this country. Millions of people are at risk of hunger, and millions of those are kids here, because we have this. We have tens of millions of poor children in this country, because the hard-hearted American, particularly the conservative, says, well, they had the opportunity, and they could have gone to get them, like that. Well, what about the kids? What about the children of these people that they have no sympathy for whatsoever? They apparently have no sympathy for these children either. So you can have a three-year-old who has a parent who, according to the conservative, hasn't worked hard enough to qualify for whatever, but the child is suffering as well, lives in a poor community that has all sorts of terrible distortions in it, but ones that also jeopardize the health of children. It's a world now without conscience, or to the extent that millions of us, tens of millions of us, maybe hundreds of millions of us, do have a conscience. We have yet not worked out a way to make that conscience a reality, and that's the real task in front of us. All right, thank you very much. Thanks for calling in from Toledo, Nick. I've got to take a break. Jolene and I will be right back. If you want to call in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and joined by Julene Jordan. And you can call us. Some open lines have suddenly, what's everybody, they call and then they drop off. You're driving Al Slayer, our phone screener, insane. 313-298-WRIF, somewhere or other I have tucked away. Have you memorized?
We breezed through those phone calls. I think that's why.
Yeah.
We had to...
Did you? I don't have it. Where my little cheat sheet. I can't remember. Do you know what 313?
No.
298-WRIF?
No. I used to.
Oh, here it is. Oh, that almost bit me. 313-298-9743. Email, which I haven't even looked at tonight.
No. That.
Call talkyes at yahoo.com and also myspace.com, Night Call Detroit.
Hey, Peter, you know, I was driving down Woodward Avenue today, going down to visit a friend at the Henry Ford Hospital, and we were talking about children and being hungry. And, you know, there's several, I don't know what they call these centers, what they are for missions or whatever. There's different types up and down Woodward Avenue. And it was, I wept on the way down there because I saw all of these people just pouring out of there, having to go there to eat their meal, you know. And I know they have to do that every day, but they were just pouring out of there today.
Yeah. And we put a lot of emphasis on charity. And you know that the people that give the biggest percentage of their income to charity are the working class. Then it's the middle class. And then the people that give the least are, of the percentage are the wealthy.
Well, that makes sense to you and I, doesn't it?
But one of the things...
But I mean, there are a lot of wealthy who do give money, right?
Well, there are some. You know, that charity, though, is vertical. That is to say that it maintains the same the things as they are. Like there now, you may have heard me... I've said this in years. Yeah, you've probably heard every story I've ever told. But the, one of the... I think it was a few winters. Actually, you know, it was a... About 6-7 years ago, a wealthy doctor that my wife and I know, his wife was watching television, and they were showing these poor people in downtown Detroit sleeping in the streets. And she went out to a department store and bought about 10 blankets.
Really?
And went to, yeah. So this was really good-hearted of her. And she seemed like you. She almost wept at the fact that people in at 0 degrees and people are sleeping in the streets. But nothing changed. They were warmer sleeping on the streets, and they were still living in their gated community with the on a lake.
True.
So,
that's very true.
Yeah.
You know when you and I used to work downtown?
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a guy every day that if he was there, I gave him money. And this guy, he got to be waiting for me, you know. But it's the same thing. I gave him a little money. Some days I would give him a little more than others if I was feeling, you know, like I had a little extra to give. But then I'd go home to my nice warm house and nothing changed for this guy.
Well, and on one hand, there's nothing particularly you and I can do as an isolated individual.
Right.
We can be generous like that. And I mean, what I've tried to do, for instance, I think I've said before that my wife and I no longer buy anybody any presents at all. We always say
I kind of wanted to talk to you about that.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. You do good things.
Yeah. I mean, so what we do is, like, for instance, we've been channeling a lot of money to the people that are still trying to deal with the Bush-caused wreckage of New Orleans from Katrina still. So there's all these medical facilities and what's called food not bombs that provide for the poor there.
They're fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, and one that I donated to was for the animals that were...
Farm sanctuary?
Abandoned. No, the animals that were abandoned.
Oh, in
Katrina.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here, this is from Don, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. In Toledo, he writes, the following is a link to a site I found that clearly communicates the fundamental differences between liberals and conservatives. I think it would be a great site to bring to the attention to your listeners or even link to from your site, which I agree. It's too long, really, to give that people will get it. He says, I'm a longtime listener of your show and of WRIF. I even remember Dick the Bruiser in the Morning, which is probably before your time.
Well, it was before my time, but I know the name.
Yeah. Here is the difference. This ought to get the phones ringing. The conservative worldview, if you think this, is essentially based on violence and threat of and fear of.
What, keeping like a war economy going?
Well, that's one aspect of it. But everything of, since there are such authoritarians, there is always this demand for conformity. And always, the only way, how can you demand it of somebody? So I want you to conform. You say, screw you.
And, well, yeah, that just makes people like you and I run further the other direction.
What they need are these social apparatuses that force you to conform. So they either kind of control, you know, mass popular opinion, or when it really gets out of hand, the police or the army.
Yeah.
Liberals, the left in general, they're going to love this, is based on imagination, or if you will, imagine.
Now, who said this?
Your old pal Pete.
You, Wait a minute here. You're saying that we are, everything we're doing is just imagination?
Oh, no, I don't mean that. It's based on our capacity to imagine a world.
Oh, a better world.
A better world.
Like the song.
Like the song.
Okay,
there you go.
Okay, thank you.
Isn't somebody we know actually going to sing that? I can't remember who it is.
Oh, wait, that's me.
Yeah, that's you.
Yeah. I love covering that song.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
Even my Republican father likes that song, but I don't think he really listens to the words.
Do it. That is the most imagined by John Lennon.
Well, you know, I tried to explain that.
It's so radical. What do you want to explain?
I said that to him. I said, he said, oh, that's a good one. You know, that's a good song. Because I had a show in my hometown, and I'm in, he's got a kind of a music room, and so I've got my band rehearsing in there. Oh, that's a good one. I go, you know, that's a pretty radical song there, Dad. I don't care about that. It's a good song.
And
it's the Beatles.
And yeah. Your dad played on your album, right?
He did.
Yeah.
Yes,
and there's actually a review on us, Jolene, is too modest. You know, you can't be in show business and be modest.
I know,
it's
bad.
It's ridiculous. You got to be a major self-promoter. Anyway, so I do it for her.
You do, and
but
I appreciate it.
There is a review of Jolene's CD in the brand new Fifth Estate newspaper. You can go to fifthestate.org, fifthestate.org, and I think there's somewhere there if you hook up with it. You can get a free copy of it. And it's a rave review, isn't it?
Oh, I was thrilled. I cried.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is funny. By the way, I wrote to the woman who did the review of it. And I said, one of the many things I like about women is they cry when they're happy.
Right.
Yeah.
And I did.
And just as I said that, almost, a friend of mine called from Tennessee who had just gotten a promotion within the college, and he was crying. So I said, well, there goes my
idea. Yeah, there's that theory.
313-298-WRIF. Let's go back to our phones. Here is Marion in Dearborn. Marion, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You are on the air.
Hi, Peter, Jolene.
Hi.
I'm a postal worker. I work at the facility next to Walter Reuther's old local.
Oh, yeah. Ah.
And our contract runs out in 2012, and after that, the speculation is anybody's guess.
Wow.
We may be all out in the street because they've been privatizing for years. A lot of our workers are casual employees. They make less than half than we do. No benefits and no union representation, and that's the wave of the future.
Right. Well, that's what they think. I think that union, I mean, it looks like unions are almost on the way out. I forgot, in the private sector, what is it? Isn't it something like 12% or less? I mean, if it wasn't for public workers like yourself being unionized, there would be next to nobody other than kind of some of the elite industries or the ones that they haven't been able to break yet. And they're thinking about it.
Yeah, my grandfather, he worked for Bud Wheel, and he helped bring the union in at Bud Wheel. And he had goons waiting for him at the end of a cornfield, and he had to crawl between rows of corn and in the crawling through his back bedroom window because they were waiting with weapons to do him serious bodily harm.
Yeah, that I was going to say the Bud Wheel organizing in the late 1930s, early 1940s was pretty rough. Now, I don't know if everyone knows, Walter Reuther was one of the founders of the United Auto Workers. And in fact, he himself, there's famous photographs of what they call the Battle of the Overpass, where Henry Ford's goon squad called the Ford Service Department attacked Walter Reuther and beat the crap out of him. And there's you can see famous photos of that if you go, like, down to the UAW headquarters. They've got them in, around the place. But you say you're next to his old local? You mean in in Romulus?
In Romulus on Van Bourne, just past Middle Belt Road.
I know. Actually, our old friends, George and Julius, who are labor folk singers, are going to be at an event there. Coming up, I can't remember the date.
That's on your website, though.
It's on my website. On my Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. That's Local 174, what they call the West Side Local, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
Have you ever been inside there?
I've never been inside there. I go past it every day on my way to work because the facility I work at is right next to it.
God, it's
funny. Priority Mail Center.
That's so bizarre. I've been there so many times to Local 174. And I've never noticed that. But if you go in there, they have one of these amazing labor murals that was done, I think, in the early 1940s. And And it was really forward thinking because there was, you know, so much of labor was segregated, but they have African Americans in it. They have women workers, and this is even, I think, before the war. So you can just go in there. They're good people. Wait a minute. Here it is. This is called. It's going to be Saturday, April 21st, from 3:30 to 6 p.m. Wait a minute. Wrong one. Sorry. It's Saturday, April 28th. People Before Profit. It's a Workers' Memorial Day concert. And what it is that in 1987, Workers' Memorial Day was set up to honor those who have been sacrificed at the altar of human greed. And that's what we've been talking about. And what it is it honors the people that have been killed and injured on the job each year, because the vast majority of people that are injured on the job or killed on the job, if it wasn't for the companies and owners trying to eke out as much profit as they could, this could be reduced incredibly. In fact, Bushco has executive orders has reduced a lot of worker safety rules and what have you. These guys, man, I hate them. Have I told you tonight how much I hate these people?
No.
Ditto.
Yeah. But it's going to be at the UAW Local 174, 29841 Van Born Road in Romulus. And George Mann and Julius Margolin return to Detroit, to the Detroit area, performing songs to fan the flames of discontent.
Oh, they are really good.
Yeah.
And how old is it? George, the older one, or Julius?
No, Julius Margolin is like 93 or something like that.
He's picking and a grinning.
Yeah. oh my God! Listen, it says so, and this is and cooking. They have a meal there. They have the Wobbly Kitchen. The Wobblies. That's the name for the old industrial workers of the world. You can go to IWW.org, and they were big. During like 100 years ago, till the government smashed them. You know, they didn't like any radical unions around. But so it says here on their site, so all good workers, come ye down to the West Side Local as we remember the 50,000 people who, due to the boss's unquenchable lust for profit, perish each and every year. Can this be 50,000 people? Oh, we got to check this. That sounds extravagant. 50,000 people a year die in the job? Could that be, Marion?
They said, I heard that that's actually a low number because with more and more people unemployed, that it would be higher if not for that.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, so go down there and check out the local and check what's on there.
And if you get hurt on the job, they write you up. Because I broke my arm due to a safety hazard when I worked downtown, and the supervisors did everything they could to try and write me up to cover their own butts, but they couldn't because it was something that was completely I could do nothing about. It was just a safety hazard, and I got hurt.
Yeah. Well, all right, Marion. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call, and we'll be down to see George and Julius. They sing too. George is a trip.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
He's got a great song, Let's Impeach the President.
It's
and,
great music.
From a few years ago, the Supreme Court stole the election.
Oh, yeah.
Now, wait a minute here. Somebody's calling me to test, sort of. Deborah. Deb writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. I know you have said you aren't interested in your MySpace site, but it is my feeling you might want to be familiar if you're going to mention and endorse the site. The song Jolene sings on your MySpace is too loud. It starts quiet and then quickly gets blasting loud. If it were Metallica, I wouldn't mind the loudness.
Okay. Well, you know what? I think every computer is different.
I think because I've heard it all the way through.
Yeah, it doesn't do that on my computer. No one else has told me. But it could be just your computer. And you know what? MySpace is a real, I don't know, funky kind of thing sometimes.
I'm glad you're dealing with it.
Yes, I know.
But it's myspace.com/nightcalldetroit.
I'm going to switch the songs out. Peter made me keep that song on there.
She had a David Rovick song, and I'm thinking, Jolene.
Then I had Dear Mr. President by Pink,
which is
love.
A terrific song.
Yeah.
I think you only ought to put your songs on there. I mean, yeah, she's embarrassed. I mean, this is, you can't be modest.
I know.
You cannot be modest. All right, 313-298-WRIF.
Work on it, Peter.
This is Will in Clinton Township. Will, hi. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thanks.
I just want to make a little comment. I'm 23, which means I'm not, you know, that experienced, if you will, in a lot of what, in a lot of the world politics. But personally, I classify myself as an independent. And I've worked, actually worked, I'm from Detroit, and I've worked in the auto industry for a number of years until I got laid off. And I was working in a non-union shop.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some people who were coming in that were from unions and stuff like that. Not actually from the unions, but they had got laid off, and they started working for us. And a non-union and a union shop are two completely different things as far as safety and stuff like that. I would say that the non-union shop that I worked at had a lot of safety built into it. It was very, very focused on safety. And maybe it's just, you know, what happened for me or whatever at the shop I worked at. But a lot of the stories that you hear about, you know, unions and things like that is that they're real lazy. And I would think that has a little bit to do with why Ford and a lot of the big three are doing so bad, is that the unions have made it so people can be lazy and...
No, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Well, if you think about it, all the aspects of production are controlled by the company. Now, I remember a few months ago we had somebody, or maybe it was even longer because I don't think Jolene was here, but someone said it's because of all these lazy UAW janitors. That's what was going on. I mean, these janitors that don't do anything. For one thing, I'm not a big fan of efficiency. That's the concern of the employer. And I don't think that people should be working, like, for instance, the Japanese, they have people working 55 minutes an hour. And I think it's like 40 or 45 with American workers. You say, oh, yeah, we should have them work like that. Well, what the hell? I mean, that's called a speed up. And what we ought to be able to, and I've never worked on a production line, but it doesn't appear to be a lot of fun, nor have the friends of mine who have say it was any fun, even at 40 minutes an hour. And we ought to be able to slow things down a little. But anyway, back to the lazy UAW janitors. So, and this takes the heat off the suits who are the brains behind it all. Somehow they're being sunk by lazy UAW janitors. And instead of bad management decisions and cars that aren't up to snuff, and again, they're the ones that control all this. It's not, the workers are just putting the widgets together. So I said to this guy, how many UAW janitors do you think there are? And he said, huh? You know you got him when a person says, huh? And I said, what part of the question didn't you understand or hear? Because, of course, it's just sort of one of these urban myths, and they have no idea. I have no idea. I don't know whether there's 100 UAW janitors or 10,000.
We got to know a few of them when we were at Solidarity House.
Yeah, and
they're working their butts off.
I'll tell you how the unions are lazy. They're lazy about, and they're finally getting the message a little late in the game, they're lazy about organizing. They were just real comfortable because all bureaucracies, as I said last week, begin to have their sole function is reproducing the bureaucracy. And things seem to be going along okay. The UAW workers, you know, back 10 years ago were making, you know, good money, and the UAW heads, I mean, they don't make a fortune like the Teamsters or some of these other unions, but some of them actually even turned into kind of rackets. Now, my union is terrific. Actually, it is. The American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and I'm going to a conference in New York City at the end of April when our union is finally figured out. We better start organizing some new people in the industry because we've lost about 25% of our members because of consolidation, and we're going to wind up without a union because that's the goal of employers, to have unionless labor. Everybody knows, or they should, that by far and away that union workers make more money, have more benefits, and have better safety conditions and better retirement, all that stuff. Now, there's exceptions. There are union shops that are really crappy, and there's non-union shops that are really good. And perhaps you were working at one. There are individual employers that are very conscientious, try to pay people a decent wage, and want a decent place to work. But in the main, overall, that ain't the case. And sometimes unions at their worst, usually I say the only thing worse than a union at some of these places is no union. Although, well, I mean, the union movement in America needs a major shakeup. It needs to, and this is internal. This is not what it's providing for its members, but it has to become a dynamic social movement the way it was. We were talking about Walter Reuther back in Walter Reuther's time. It has to be balls to the wall. Can I say that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's see. So where are we? I'm just kind of looking down the row here. All right. Here's Bill in Livonia. Bill, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Bill.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Thanks.
We did, we did 32 years at Ford Motor Company as a salary person.
You did?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And about 2 months ago, they gave us these window packages.
Uh-huh.
And they called us up and they said, we strongly recommend that you take these packages. Excuse me. And we all did.
Were you unionized?
No. Sorry.
Okay.
So now it's April, Easter, and we haven't received any money from Ford Motor Company.
I mean, these are buyouts.
Right.
Right. Well, they're going to pay you, I think.
But you're not. Are you working?
No.
No.
So how long has it been?
It's been since February 28th.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Well, I can understand you wanting the money.
They're going to cut you a check. I mean, I don't think that's. I mean, that would be a scandal. Well, maybe they had to pay the Ford CEO his 28
million. Well, that was my point. Because right after most of us retired, we heard that the CEO got this big bonus.
Yeah.
And then they go, well, they can give this guy a bonus, but we're still waiting for our retirement checks.
Oh, yeah, here it is. He got an $18.5 million bonus, almost $9 million in stock and options, and at a base salary at an annual $2 million rate. Wow. That's like at Delphi, the parts manufacturer that's almost went belly up. And they managed to give, first thing they wanted to do, they wanted to renegotiate all the union contracts and take people who are making $16, $18 an hour and cut their pay in half. And then they gave out tens of millions of dollars to their executives because they really think we're peasants. This is the peasantization of the economy. And because we don't do anything. And I'm not being critical like of you or anybody else, because the way to do it is not open. The form, the political or social form to which to fight back against this looting of our economy with us as the victims isn't clear yet. But I think it's going to be. Hey, I got to get some commercials in before, and actually a pretty short one, so hang on. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. But we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
From that someone that is the end of the trial. Yes, yeah. back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Back with you for another hour of your phone calls at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And joining me, Jolene Jordan.
Why, thank you.
This actually a sad day. This is, I don't know if I can do the math, 29 years. To you and Jolene. Oh, this is nice. Let me see. Terry writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You and Jolene, you are great as co-host. Well, greater than great, since Peter was already great as a solo, might want to give a nod of appreciation to Phil Oakes, the folk singer. His contribution, his insight, and his heart. He committed suicide on April 9th, 1978.
Oh,
and our friend David Rovics, R-O-V-I-C-S, davidrovics.com, he's called the Phil Oakes of this generation. And if you're not familiar with Phil Oakes, you might give a listen. Incredible.
Oh, yes, do.
Incredible music.
On my MySpace, it's, you know, mostly about music, and you put in who some of your influences are and who you admire, and Phil's on my list.
Well, we gave a shout-out to Shelby at
radiopower.org,
and actually I was going to talk about something else, but where is it here?
You have so much
this
material
is about, yeah,
in there.
She
Ms.
says Kirby. That time to rip your senator. Indeed, rip him a new one. The Senate will not stop paying for the Iraq war or relent from insisting that President Bush keep pressing the Baghdad government for a negotiated end, according to Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. He says he took issue with the Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid, who said he was going to cut off money for the war next year as a way to end U.S. involvement. And our Carl says we're not going to vote to cut funding, period. But what we should do, and we're going to do, is continue to put pressure on this president and to have him put pressure on the Iraqi leaders to reach a political settlement. Oh, God, that's really powerful.
See, I'm really confused because I thought he was...
He's a lame ball.
I'm confused.
Yeah, well, you don't have to be confused.
I thought he was on our side.
Well, you know, I'll go back to one of the reasons I got fired from the UAW network, because I kept saying the Democrats were the other half of the ruling racket.
Right.
Now, they're willing. I don't know if I can get
was
this.
Was that part of it?
Yeah. They didn't. The assistant to the president said, what was her deal? Judy. She said, they'll probably catch hell for this, even though I haven't worked there in 3 or 4 years. She said she would go to our general manager. Peter Werby just said the Democrats are the other half of the ruling racket. He said, is this what we're paying them good union money to say? Well, you're damn right.
And you know what else you used to do? I would get calls from the Democratic National Committee all the time wanting to put Congress people on. And you would say, absolutely not. So I would have to say to this woman, I remember Candy was her name.
Candy, right? Yeah.
Candy, listen. You know, I go, and finally one day I just had to say, you know, Peter is not a Democrat.
Silence.
Well, what is he? What is he?
Yeah.
She went crazy, and then she quit calling me.
Then the president's office called our general manager and said, is Peter Werby an anarchist? And she said...
Not the president of the United States.
Yeah.
Of the UAW.
Yeah. And our general manager said, well, yeah.
Been to peterwerby.com lately.
And then, so then I got called into the audience, to the office. So.
Yeah, you and I both made him mad.
Yeah,
didn't we?
Screw them both. I don't care. But here's what I wrote.
That's what we do best.
Let's see. Okay, yeah, much of what I've written in the last few months, this is a message that I send out to listeners from time to time. If you want to get on my email list, just call or write to calltalkyes@yahoo.com and say add me, and I will. But I said, much of what I've written the last few months is about trying to get people to attend demonstrations, rallies, community meetings, whatever, to try to push the Democrats into acting on the will of the American people to end the war in Iraq immediately and to begin impeachment proceedings against the criminal Bushko mob in Washington. I said I would do it. What does that mean? I would do it weekly if I wrote every 7 days. Oh, I was saying I didn't write that frequently. It has become quite clear that we're going to have to make those things happen ourselves, as the Democrats seem content to go after much of the Bushko corruption. They're doing that, which is well needed, but not challenging the basic assumptions of the empire. The Democrats' willingness to continue funding the war machine for another year and a half condemns tens of thousands more Iraqis and Americans to death and injury, and the occupied country to more devastation.
And you know what? It's not just going to be a year and a half.
No, it's
we're
not.
We're fooling ourselves.
But even if it is, in fact, where is that thing on 11?
It's going to go on for so long.
The Senate bill, he says, would require a U.S. troop exit to begin within 120 days with a completion goal of March 31st, 2008. How many people will die in between? How many sons and fathers and daughters and all of that are going to die in the meantime?
Oh, yeah.
It's over.
I had to put the paper down yesterday. It was so depressing. I mean, I was actually, I came in here to do a rock and roll air shift, and there's the paper, and I kind of look over, and I had to move it in another room because
it's difficult.
Too distracting.
Well, I've been watching watching ABC News lately, and here's what I wrote in this little newsletter. When the nightly news shows our troops in action, I'm astounded that it doesn't occur to more viewers what is going on. Boys from Texas and Michigan and everywhere in between blowing the crap out of Iraqi cities, breaking down doors in individual homes, and conducting firefights in the middle of neighborhoods. And I wrote, can you imagine what your reaction would be if this was being done by a foreign army in a city in which we live? They repeatedly show these, and they're different scenes, of just smashing down doors. And they had this photograph of an Iraqi family in the New York Times, I think today. And they were interviewing this, as they put it. Here are these, fully battle-ready American troops. This is American troops, 6,000 miles away in somebody else's house that, you can't say, I wish you wouldn't come in here. Please leave. And they're doing these retina scans and taking his fingerprints, and it shows the women in the household looking just frightened, waiting to get back to lunch. Well, probably just made another insurgent. So it's those damn Sunnis, right? Well, it turns out now, of course, it's the Shias, too. The most powerful Shiite cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, has ordered his militiamen on Sunday to redouble their battle to oust the American forces and argued that Iraq's army and police should join him in defeating, quote, your arch enemy. The U.S. military announced the weekend deaths of 10 American soldiers, including 6 killed yesterday, Sunday. And Levin is saying, we're going to keep paying for this. So right now it's a bipartisan war. They're sort of arguing when the end of it is and what have you. But the Democrats are part of all of this as well. In the meantime, in Najaf, thousands of Iraqis streamed to the holy southern city of Najaf on Sunday in response to a call by the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr for a big anti-American protest on Monday, which, what is it, like 6 hours difference?
Yeah, you think they're happy we're there? No.
So what is up with this? I mean, who is our enemy there? So it's the Sunnis, it's the Shiites. The only people you could probably really pinpoint are the probably couple thousand foreign fighters that have been organized by al-Qaeda. But the rest of them are the average Iraqis who want us to get the hell out of there. The American people want us to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
And Carl Levin, the Democratic senator from Michigan, who at least voted against the war amendment the war authorization back in 2003, is now joined the Democrats into funding this war. The only funds, it should be the immediate withdrawal, and the funds should be funded to get us out there, somehow declare peace. Say to Muqtada al-Sadr, hey, we're out of here. We're stopping any offensive actions. And people say it's going to be a civil war. It's going to be a civil war whenever we get out. If we get out tomorrow, it's going to be a civil war. If we get out of there in a year and a half, in a civil war. And you know whose fault it is? The liars that got us in there under false pretenses. Bush and Cheney and the rest of these guys. Not only are they lying, they're stupid liars, because they thought they could lie us in and then we'd win like that and everybody would think they were great. Well, they lied and then they were wrong about absolutely everything that they said. They're responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, mostly Iraqis, but enough Americans to make us cry because they're from our neighborhoods in our states.
And they sleep like babies at night.
You think so? I hope not. They probably do. They are so evil.
I think they do, because they are so evil.
You know, we ought to have How Evil Are They Department.
I like that.
Yeah. Actually, I have a few things, but a lot of people are patiently waiting, so we'll get back to you. Peter and Jolene at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Russ. Russ is in Clarkston. Russ, thanks for being so patient. You're on the air.
Actually, actually, I'm not in Clarkson anymore. I'm already made it to Lapeer, holding on. But thank you. Hey, good evening, guys.
Hi.
Good evening.
And you know, this is the first time in a very, very long time that I've actually tuned in, because normally I'm in bed right now. But I've got just a few things to talk about, because I guess I first started tuning in when I heard you talking about some of the homeless and things that we should do. But guys, I got to admit, if you keep my mind here, this is not a personal attack. I hear things such as the Bush, the Bush wreckage of
that's good. It's good so far.
Yeah, okay, the Bush wreckage down in Louisiana.
Right.
And I just heard you say that. Do you think they want us there? Hell no. Well, guys, I've actually shaken hands with three different military men and women that recently just arrived home in Michigan, and I actually met them down in the Troy area. And I'm here to tell you that straight from soldiers' mouth. Now, I wasn't there. I don't know for certain.
What did they say?
The soldiers told me point blank what they know is being pumped out in our media on CNN and ABC, etc., that they are not appreciative of us being there. They're lying to us. That men and women of the Iraqi citizens come out in the streets, shake our hands, and thank us for trying to liberate their country.
Well, let's
I think some do. I think there is a small percentage of Iraqis who do.
They've done. I got to tell you, Russ, that they've done these polls. The majority of people want the U.S. out. The majority of Iraqis in the polls that are taken want us out. And a majority of people think that attacks on U.S. troops are legitimate.
I understand. I understand. And you know what? I'm not afraid to admit I'm a Republican. And I'm also not afraid to admit both Democrats and Republicans are liars, you know, and unfortunately...
But wait. How can you call yourself an adherent of people you say are liars? That's why I'm not a Democrat, because they're part of the ruling racket, as are the Republicans, who don't have the interests of the average people in mind. Why would you be a Republican and then identify them as liars?
I'll explain. What I guess I should have said is my beliefs, my core beliefs, my core values happens to be more in line of what I believe to be a Republican view versus a Democrat or independent. But what I will say is this. I think it's sad that we're at a point in time in our history right now that many people, including myself, go to the voting booth, and we're basically pulling the lever of the lesser of two evils.
Right.
And that's sad. And that's a sad state. But the point that I was trying to make when I called in originally is two key words, dependency and perception. And when you talk about homeless people and the people who provide charity and people who go to missions to eat and all those things, I completely understand. I was listening very contently. But my question is, how many of those people find it easier to go do that, or easier to stand on the street corner and ask for help, that have sane body, sane mind, and could go out and try to do something for themselves?
Well, first off, the vast majority of people in that situation are women with dependent children and their dependent children. That old thing about able-bodied males not being able to being more content to get welfare. Well, first off, no able-bodied man in Michigan is eligible for welfare, so there's nobody there. So they're now just dependent on charity. So, the Salvation Army, there's not enough beds. Look, this is not individual, what would you call it, initiative. We're talking about a vast social definition where we have millions of homeless people in this country. I mean, why do we wind up in a country that have so many people that have that characteristic suddenly? Why do we have a state that has so much unemployment? Because we have lazy people or a dumb governor or something like that? I mean, there's the same thing that's happening to us is happening in other states as well. the economy is being looted by these and led by these people that whose party you have adherence to. And it never was very fair, but what they've raised it to, and what I was saying earlier, Russ, they've raised it to completely a level of a racket. And we're the ones that are getting ripped off.
Peter, I understand many of your points that you're trying to make, and it's not that I disagree with everything that you say, but, you know, another point regarding the perception is one of the big political debates that we hear every year during an election year is minimum wage. And I am so tired of hearing people get a microphone stuck in their face and say, you know what, I can't raise my family on minimum wage. Therefore, the minimum wage, minimum.
You know, you're kind of heartless.
Raise a family of four on minimum wage, even if you have three jobs. And I can attest to that in parts of my life, okay? And all we are saying here on this show, I think, is that let's give people a living wage. We're not asking to give them $1 million. Just give them a living wage.
Yeah, not even a minimum wage. And if we want to be number one, how come we're the wealthiest country in the world in terms of total aggregate wealth, yet we have the highest number of poor people, a percentage of the population, and officially they say there's like 40 million poor people in this country, which is vastly underestimated, because they say a family of four can live on like $19,000 a year.
Well, can you imagine that? Yeah, let's ask him that.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
We are the wealthiest country, just like you said, but we are also the most giving in terms of what we provide in charitable contributions, et cetera.
That's not true in the slightest. I don't know whether you're talking about foreign aid. Actually, the like 90% of that goes to military aid. This deal that the United States was going to sell all this weaponry to the United Arab Emirates and I think Egypt, a number of places like that. And Israel complained that we were selling, that the United States was going to sell too much military hardware to these Arab countries. And I'm thinking, on one hand, what the hell is some foreign country trying to put a brake on what the United States is selling? But even more of a question is, what in the world is the United States doing selling all this sophisticated weaponry to this volatile region of the world where we, with our tax dollars, because this is the kind of aid that goes out, arming everybody to the teeth? We're not generous at all. We're not generous to our own people. How can we have 80 million probably poor people in this country and call this country generous? The USA is Scrooge. We screw tens of millions of hardworking people, their kids, their families, and their communities, and all of this money goes to the war industries or the prison industries or tax cuts for the ultra wealthy. You got to find a different political party.
I would say the priorities are just a little bit messed up.
Skewed. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
I do appreciate that he was working with us there, Peter. He was trying.
Yeah.
He was being calm.
Well,
he wasn't yelling at us.
You know, they used to have people during the... we were less calm than him. But I mean, the fact of some suburbanite... Excuse me, I live in the suburbs. Jeline lives in the suburbs. But some suburbanite without a clue of what it means to be poor in this country or poor in the world is pretty galling. And really lacks compassion. That's another thing, that conservatives lack compassion. You want some more definitions of conservative? Lack compassion.
Wait, I tell you, I'm concerned about my niece and nephew are growing up in what I would consider extreme privilege. And I'm concerned that they don't understand. But so I had this long talk with my sister about this. And so she's trying to do little things, you know. I mean, you know, we're going to go down and we're going to go to the Salvation Army and donate today. So she's starting small, but I'm working on them because I don't want these beautiful children to grow up and be cold-hearted Republicans who don't give a you-know-what about people who are less fortunate than them. That would break my heart more than anything.
They have a wonderful program in Detroit called Detroit Summer, and I don't think we've ever mentioned that before, and I'm sure they have a website, but if you Google Detroit Summer, you'd get, wow, here, let's get Chris on the air. Chris, you may hold the record. Thanks for being so patient. You've been waiting a long time. My apologies.
How are you doing tonight?
Doing great.
You were talking about the Iraq war.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do you feel about us going into Iran soon?
Well, I don't.
Terrified?
Well, I don't think we're going to go into Iran. I mean, we don't have the troops to go into Iraq. They're involuntary mobilization of these National Guardsmen. And what National Guard?
I thought they were back to their fourth.
Yeah. Well, I thought they were supposed to defend this, in case of invasion. So no, they're not going to invade Iran.
I think that's what these global elitists want. They want us in Iran. So.
Well, we
you could be right.
Fortunately, because these people that run this country are quite mad that the troops aren't there. The only thing that could happen is that Bushko, in their total madness, could try to take out some of their facilities with airstrikes and missile strikes. But I can't even believe that they're that insane. I mean, the more chaotic things are, the more people begin to depend on them, like after 9/11, which is the only time they ever had any real popularity. So they might think, well, gee, if we bombed Iran and then things started going to hell all over the Middle East, and Iran said, essentially, hey, if you attack our country, we'll attack your country.
Look out, yeah. And you know what? I bet we get, I'm going to make a bet with you for nothing.
Okay.
That we'll get phone calls. But what about those British hostages? All hostages.
Well, what if.
What about that?
What if Iranians had operatives in this country?
And, yeah. In our waters, you mean?
Yeah, well, no, in our cities.
Country? Oh.
And all of a sudden, we attack their country. And what happens when one country attacks, and particularly since that Iran has done nothing to the United States whatsoever, except be involved to meddling in Iraq. I mean, isn't the United States major meddling in Iraq?
Yeah, and isn't Saudi Arabia majorly meddling in Iraq?
So, but to have a full-scale attack for a country like ours to travel 6,000 miles to attack Iran, maybe they might think, well, we're going to blow off what we've got waiting for you in your country if you do that. And wouldn't that be tit for tat? Can I say that on the air?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you may.
All right. You know what I mean? So they, but then if there were like terrorist attacks in the United States or bombs that were planted went off, this then would give Bushko the last grasp at power and popularity. It's a frightening concept.
I really think Bush is just a servant for the global elite. So.
Well, I mean, he's both. He's a servant and he's part of the global elite. I mean, I suppose he only has millions, and that probably doesn't qualify him for the global elite.
That we know of.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, thank you for bringing that up, Chris. I appreciate it. And here's Steve in Westland, also waiting a long time. Thank you for waiting, and you're on the air.
Hi. First off, I'd like to say I love your show. It's the greatest show I've ever heard.
Well, thank you.
Wow.
And this is just going back on your earlier point about safety and plants.
Yeah.
I was working in a factory a while ago, about 7 years back. I won't say the name of it because they improved their practices for a while. But
okay.
It was a safety issue because a girl that was working on one of the press machines actually crushed three of her fingers in the machine.
Uh-huh.
And it took our maintenance guys not once but twice to press the emergency stop button before it stopped, before it pulled her actually into the machine.
Yikes.
And the maintenance went back the next day, and we actually checked out the button, and he had to hit it so hard that it was broken.
Well, maybe there is something to, what do we say, 50,000, was it deaths a year? I forgot.
That's what it said.
Yeah, 50,000 deaths. This is going to be commemorated, as we were saying earlier, on Workers' Memorial Day, which, if I can get this to open, what, I can't remember the date. Was it the 21st?
28th, I think.
28th, that's right. 28th, yeah. Yeah.
And the funny thing was that I went in, the next night because our parent company in Germany had all these, safety procedures set up. And it was funny. Every single machine had guards set up.
Huh. So
it's like I walked in, it's like, oh, gee, we couldn't have these like a month ago,
Yeah.
You know, it's something has to happen before they take, you know, it serious.
That is very unfortunate, and they usually are concerned about liability rather than our fingers. All right, thank you very much for bringing that up. Yeah, Saturday, April 28th is Workers' Memorial Day. And on the 21st, I know I'm fixating on the 21st, Ravi Shankar, the sitar player.
Oh, yeah. You know who his daughter is, don't you?
The boxer. Oh, no, that's Muhammad Ali's.
I did see her fight, though.
She's on Dancing with the Stars.
I know. She's got moves.
Wow, yeah.
The girl's got moves.
Yeah.
No, Norah Jones. Norah Jones, the singer, is Ravi Shankar. Is that how you say it? His daughter.
What?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, you know about those things.
'Tis true. They were estranged. And
Ravi Shankar is a sitar player and was the instructor of George Harrison.
I think he is like the world-renowned sitar player.
So he's going to be at Orchestra Hall the 21st. And we got to get you a computer because you could do what I'm doing now because I'm trying to find out.
I live in the easy life over here, Pete.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out the deaths per year. Here's Jim and Taylor. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. A couple comments. I'm wondering if you heard about the... that woman in Florida, I guess she set that place on fire, allegedly, set that pet, I'm not sure if it was a pet, like a humane society or something like that.
I missed it.
No.
What's the significance?
I was just saying, anybody that, you know, purposely hurts animals, you know, tortures them and stuff like that, they should make them, force them to be a member of, it's ASPCA. ASPCA.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
They should force them to be a member of that and contribute towards that foundation. And there's a number of foundations that they can contribute to, you know, besides that one.
Those are the kind of people I'd like to see in jail. Somebody who's smoking a little bud, but geez.
Should be shot. I think a firing squad would be appropriate, of course, but...
Well, even for that, we're against the death penalty. Right. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Here, I was managed to multitask here. And this
good job,
this is the Associated Press from 2001 to 2002. Total on-job deaths fell from 5,915 workers to 5,524. Where does the 50,000 come in?
That was just Michigan you were talking about, right?
No. Oh, this is all across the United States.
Well, there's a little project for you. A big project for you, it sounds like.
I know these people, so I'll ask them, what's up?
Yeah, get those numbers.
Here is Al in Inkster. Al, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
How you doing tonight, Peter?
Doing good.
You know how weak the union movement has gotten?
Tell me.
The Canadian auto workers last weekend staged a successful sit-in.
Oh, yeah.
On two plants in Canada. Against Tower Automotive.
Right.
And you know what they hope to gain?
What?
Their severance pay packages from when the plants close in July.
Wow.
I mean, that's when you think about what they did with the sit-in in Flint and what they were hoping to gain there and what they just did.
Yeah.
And that shows you how, because I read in today's Detroit News a columnist, Nolan Finley.
No! I hate Nolan Finley.
A man who should probably be flogged.
Yeah.
Still had it.
Yeah.
That bad?
With wet spaghetti.
Okay, wet spaghetti.
I was on a panel with him a couple of years ago at Wayne State. Now, all we were talking about was, is news coverage getting worse? And everybody said it was getting worse. And he, of course, defended things as they are. And I said, I actually agree with Nolan Finley. I said, it's awful. It's terrible. It misrepresents reality. It misrepresents particularly social movements as it's done since its inception. And essentially, your paper, Nolan, and the rest of the MSM, the mainstream media, are pieces of crap.
That's funny. Someone told me that we should have Lou Dobbs on
from CNN
because they say this person said that this guy is down with our program.
Oh, he is not.
Okay, and I answered for you, Peter. I said, there is no way Peter would even allow me to even attempt to make that phone call.
But Nolan Finley, so So I was, there was about five of us on the panel, including Joanne Watson from the Detroit City Council. And but if you're looking at it, there was the moderator in the middle, and to her right was me, and to her left was Nolan Finley. So I said something. He said he had to leave by 10 to 7. So I looked, and it was 10 to 7. And I said, and behind her back, somebody else was talking. I said, hey, Nolan, it's 10 to 7. And he says, F you.
Good job, Peter.
Yeah.
That's basically what he said in his column today. He wants to remove the state from, quote, the iron grip of labor by making it a right-to-work state.
Oh, God. That's so off the agenda, fortunately.
And then he talks about how well the right-to-work states are to work in, how they're getting all the big paychecks and all the jobs.
Did you check your blood pressure after you read that article? Maybe you
actually,
should not
I
read
did.
Him.
He's a professional liar. I mean, that's what he does. Somebody
I got one.
Yeah, go ahead.
One last comment on how to tell the difference between whether you're conservative or a liberal.
Yeah.
This goes back to my dad.
Sure.
He said liberals treat dogs like they're people, and conservatives treat people like they're dogs.
Oh,
my gosh.
I love it.
Wow.
I love it.
That's one, yeah.
That is
never
terrific.
Never heard that.
I'm going to keep this. That's true. I mean, both being dog owners.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
My little dog, he's going to have her stitches out tomorrow.
Oh, the baby.
Yeah, the baby. He's ready to rock and roll again.
Right.
All right. Let's see. We have a call from Holland, although it's Holland, Ohio. Ed, hi. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us here in Detroit.
Hey, Pete. How you doing?
Doing good.
That's good. Hey, kind of a different spin on this thing. You know, if we were occupied by a foreign military power.
Yeah.
You know, guys that talk funny and look funnier than us.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think we'd be insurgents too?
I would. How about you?
Me being the redneck auto worker bluegrass musician I am, I wouldn't really take to a shakedown too well if every time I stopped and bought gas.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd probably be wanting a little payback. I'd be getting a little tired of it.
Everybody on my block is armed to the teeth, being good
yeah.
Americans. So.
Well, I'm not. You know where I'm going? I'm going to go live where John Sinclair lives in Amsterdam. Out of here. Yeah.
In Holland. But
in the other Holland.
Yeah.
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 But, it's funny because we're throwing away all of our civil liberties. And trying to give it to these people that don't know what civil liberties are, and it's not our fight to begin with. And I was against this war back in 2003, and I'm even more against it now. And I love the Dixie Chicks. I personally love my country, but I sure don't like this government.
Yeah, well, you know, the conservatives during the 90s had this bumper sticker that said, I love my country, but I don't trust my government. And suddenly they packed in all those, and that might be a good sticker for the rest of us.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Thanks for calling in from Holland. Appreciate
Maybe
it.
Maybe I should put on that Dixie Chicks song on our
website.
On our
not ready to be nice.
Yeah,
yeah.
Not ready to make nice.
Not ready to make nice.
Yeah.
You know, whatever happened, there was a Dixie Chick documentary.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Put
I
it on
haven't
your,
seen that.
Put it on your Netflix list.
All right, so many things to do.
Yeah, there is. So little time.
Let's take a break.
I was going to give you a little movie review, but it's not even worth bringing up the movie I saw. Never mind.
Okay.
Yeah. It was, what's the name of it?
Borat?
The Last Mimsy.
Borat's good. Have you seen it yet?
Oh, God.
Peter, you're coming over to my house and you're watching it.
I watched it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's a complicated film. We'll be right back. Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF. Couple open lines for you.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit. Every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Is WRIM.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. And this is our final segment, so give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, if you're elsewhere in the country or the world, you can do the math easy enough. I'm going to be interviewing Jonathan Cohn. He's an editor at the New Republic. He's got a book out called Sick about our health system. Actually, Michael Moore's film is premiering in Flint, Michigan, where he's from. I think this coming week. It's called Sicko. You got to put your own mic on, girl.
Here I am. All right. Well, I have there to work over here? All right. Okay, so boy, he whooped that together.
Max, it's been a while. I mean, isn't about three or 4 years?
Yeah,
or
no, that long. I don't know. I'm just excited. It's almost here.
Sean writes in from Port Huron to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I work at a place in Marysville in Michigan. I've been there for 11 years, and I'm careful not to name the place. I work at for reasons I don't need to name. So this is it, by the way. We're supposed to, well, because people are fearful for their job. I mean, think about that. I mean, remember I said that that the conservative worldview essentially is based on violence, and one of the things is fear. I mean, violence in lots of ways, I don't just mean physical violence, although a lot of their deal is based on physical violence, but it's fear, which is an aspect of violence. Mm-hmm. He says, the Teamster tried to get into my shop for 5 or 6 years. The last time it was closed. Now a union can, he says, a union can be good in some places, but not in others. I was told that if the union came in, there would be nothing stopping the plant from closing and moving to Mexico. Now, this is one of the threats under globalization.
Common threat, right?
Yeah, common threat. Okay, you're going to unionize, we're out of here. Or like Walmart. When they have a plan here, the owners, the Walmart.
Come on, they're getting so much better, Peter.
Well, they have billions, and if anything gets unionized, they close the store like they did in Montreal. They say,
really?
And so, what does anyone think? Somebody from the retail clerks union comes along and says, "Why don't you join our union?" And they go, "Wait a minute, what's the lesson here?" The lesson is, you'll close our store. So they rule by fear. This is not democracy. This is not anything like a democracy. So he says, I'm not sure that a union would be a bad thing if this place would not move to Mexico. I'm a single man making $12.50 an hour, which is what I've often said ought to be the minimum wage in this country. But if you, I can't do the, someone told me
that.
The easy way.
You used to have a much higher number.
No.
Now
I just want us to be number one at something good. People used to say, number one. We want to be good at something.
Number one at something good.
Yeah, like the minimum wage, and instead we're like in last place for industrialized countries. But someone, you can figure out easy enough how to, someone remind me about this. In other words, if you make $10 an hour, you can figure out your annual wage. What I do, let's say 40 hours, it's 400, and then you do it by 50, so it's $20,000 a year. But someone said if you make like $18 an hour, or 22 or 13 or 6, that you just need one little figure which gives you the amount you'll make a year. You got to add a few zeros to it to get into the thousands. Okay, someone can call or write us about that. 313-298-WRIF and calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let me see. There was one more email I wanted to. Oh, yeah. Paul from Detroit. Now, he's the guy putting together this Cinco de Marijuana.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
At DetroitLiberation.org. He says, those Iraqi firefights and doors knocked in that you mentioned, they're also happening on the streets of every American city and is by our own government and police agency. The drug war is furthering what you call the peasantization of America. Just a thought. He's monofocused. Paul, you're monofocused here. I mean, there is. I mean, the crimes committed in the name of the war on drugs is terrible.
Right.
Should I get my joke again? War on drugs? Man, I can't even drive on drugs. That's one of my favorites.
I still laugh, Peter, after all these
years. Yeah. remember the Republican that called in?
Yes, I do.
Well,
he was trying to be nice.
Rod called in. Gosh, that Republican suburban white boy was such an effing dumbass.
Oh, no. Must we name call?
He is very arrogant. And
okay, go ahead.
It is very extremely obvious that he doesn't have a clue to how it is for someone who didn't have a daddy to pay for his college and have the things he needed when he was a kid all paid for, which is you and me.
I absolutely did. But I tell you what, I didn't kind of stay in that, category, shall we say. I went into broadcasting.
Right. A big mistake. He probably had health care and looked at others like the people in Detroit is beneath him. He should stay out of Detroit because someone might beat his little mouthy ass. Well, that doesn't say much. That's not a very good. No one would. I bet that either one of his parents act like he does. Probably his dad worked for one of the big three and is now retired. I'm not in very good mood for these people right now.
I couldn't tell.
Yeah, tell us what you really think, Rod. What a bunch of fakes and losers. Imagine being a Republican.
What a joke.
Well, you know what, Peter? I understand his frustration. I hope you feel a little better by, writing it down.
Yeah.
I do understand it, though.
Have you seen the movie? I haven't seen that either. Fast Food Nation?
I've read the book.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the movie.
All right. Let's go back. We should...
We have full lines.
Yeah, we do. And so we should go back to our phone calls. Here's Brandon in Davison, Michigan, up by Flint, Michigan, the home of Michael Moore. Go ahead, Brandon. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing good.
This is the first time I ever heard your guys' show, but...
must be a shock.
Well, the first thing I agreed with about the whole war thing, my twin brother, I just found out, is getting sent overseas.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and they're calling for a year deployment.
Yeah.
For a year, did you say?
What's that?
For 1 year?
You said what kind of deployment? It kind of blipped out.
Oh, hang on. My phone's starting to die.
Well,
let me plug it in real quick.
Oh, okay.
I had to do that to you this morning, Peter.
You did.
I had to tell you that I had to plug my phone in this morning.
I did.
Well, I'm at work right now. That's another thing about that guy that called out of Lapeer.
Yeah.
Talking about minimum wage or whatever.
Right.
I work 122 hours every 2 weeks.
Oh, boy.
Just to make it by, I make $7.50 an hour.
That's insane.
And, I'm 19. Yeah, I probably could have made the choice to go in debt, but my parents could have paid it for college. So, I don't know. But the whole Iraq thing, no, I don't agree with that. And anyone else, I'd give my cell phone number out to everyone to let them know I don't agree with it. Because if anybody in the United States had to go through what we're going through as a family, knowing that you're not able to see your son or daughter for almost 2 years, that alone.
Yeah, that does terrible damage to families. And there increasingly is an understanding of what this war has done to the families, how they destroyed families, the kind of anxiety. It's true in any wartime.
Divorces.
But this is an unnecessary war. And one expects, when you're just entering the job market, like you are, Brandon, that people aren't going to make a fortune. But even still, having to work that much, and I don't know if you heard right at the beginning, I was saying there is no reason in the wealthiest country in the world why college should not be free. And in fact, if students like yourself, in order to devote themselves to their studies, not only should it be free, but there's no reason why the government couldn't pay stipends in order for them. We lost them, but I'll continue. Couldn't pay stipends. So where does it all come from? Well, that would mean that that people probably couldn't afford. We got two things. One, we can either allow an ambitious and energetic young person like Brandon to go to school and not have to also work 60 hours a week, or we could let this Mr. Weintraub in Ohio put an $80,000 backyard barbecue in his house. Those are our choices. Those are the social choices that we have to make, and it's pretty easy where I'm going to come down on it. Here's Chris in Harper Woods. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, I'm sorry. I forget her name, but anyway.
No worries.
I apologize. But I know what Brandon's going through. I got two brothers over in Iraq right now. One of them is here, and he's going back in November. And instead of actually going back to Iraq, he's actually going to Iran.
What?
Yeah. He's a Marine, and he's actually being redeployed to Iran.
You know what? I think I would check it out. There's no Americans in Iran.
Is this maybe on one of the ships that they're?
Yeah, is he in the Navy or the Air Force?
No, he's a Marine.
Hmm. Well, maybe he knows something that the rest of us don't.
Whoa.
Oh yeah, no, he's. As soon as when I heard you guys do the segment about Iraq and Iran and all that, that I had to call up and it, because I, you know, I talked to him today to wish him a happy Easter, and he's right now in Oxford. He's going back tomorrow sometime in the afternoon back to base.
Mm-hmm.
And no, he's being redeployed to Iran.
And when?
November.
Yeah.
November, Peter.
Yes.
Oh.
Because I heard you guys talking, and I was like, no, you guys got it wrong. I just heard, and maybe it's not out. I don't know what's going on, but yeah, it's to Iran.
Well, we'll check it out. Thanks for that heads up. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. I want to mostly concentrate on phone calls, but I did want to tell you this, and I don't know why I'm so late to have picked up on this. It's on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. On Saturday, April 14th is Earth Day, and there's stuff going on all over the world, and about 14 things in the Detroit area. If you go to StepItUp2007.org, StepItUp2007.org, you can find out what's going on. New global warming report issued Friday by the United Nations paints a near-apocalyptic vision of Earth's future. Hundreds of millions of people short of water, extreme food shortages in Africa, a landscape ravaged by floods, and millions of species sentenced to extinction. And despite its harsh vision, the report was quickly criticized by scientists who said its findings were watered down by last-minute governments like the U.S. seeking to deflect calls for action. So this could be one of the crusades that every one of us should be involved in. So you can go to StepItUp2007.org. This is about the future of the planet, so it might be a good idea to check it out. Here's Greg in Mount Clemens. Greg, thanks for joining us here on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
It's been a long time since I've listened. Unfortunately, I work early morning. Thankfully, I've got one of the UAW jobs, and so I got tomorrow off.
Okay.
So I get to stay up and listen to you. I've got the numbers for you from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Okay.
Oh. In 2003, it was 5,559 workers were killed on the job, 151 in the state of Michigan. And then there was another 4.1 million workers sustained non-fatal workplace injuries, and 269,500 suffered work-related illnesses.
Well, where in the hell could these people have gotten that figure?
I don't know if that's worldwide, maybe.
Maybe, or maybe, I don't know.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
It could be worldwide.
That's way too many. I mean,
yeah.
the one that you... indicated, but I'll check with those people, and because it's on my website, I don't want there's enough BS in the world without me or them adding to it. So they may be talking, I don't know what. I'm trying to put the best spin on it, but I can't.
Would be 50,000 since they started taking those.
Yeah, maybe if it's
taking those records
because they what did they? Let me see. Let me get back to it. It said it was declared in Workers' Memorial Day in 1987, so that's 20 years. So maybe it's in 20 years. Huh?
Yeah, it could be. April 28th was chosen because that's the anniversary of OSHA.
Oh, when the Office of Health, what is it, Office of Health?
Occupational Safety and Health.
Administration, yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, thank you for the information, Greg.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem.
I appreciate
lots
it.
Lots of info.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. It's, conservatives also are pretty dumb. And they don't pick up their dog poop.
Oh, geez.
But, have you ever heard when, on a conservative talk show, when a caller knew more than the host? Never. I mean,
Well, I try not to listen, first of all, but I've been forced to.
But there's people that listen that just know, so much more. I mean, everybody knows a little bit. I mean, that's...
sure.
Yeah. So, all right. Let's go to Otis. Otis is way out in Kalamazoo. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just want to let all your listeners know to go to www.infowars.com.
Oh, yeah, that's a good site, but I forgot what it is. What's it all about?
It's all about the war in Iraq. It's about 9/11 being an inside job. There's a lot of evidence on that site. Alex Jones is the one that he streams a radio show every day on that site, Monday through Friday.
Oh, that's why I know it, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, somebody, what do they want me to do? They either want me to interview him or, wow. Is it .com? Infowar.com?
Yeah.
Well, I just went to it. It says, we are upgrading our equipment and software. Come back soon for the big launch of the new Infowar.com site. Maybe it'll be, you know, sometimes they just do it on Sunday nights. So that's what it could be all about. But all right, I'll check it out. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Here's Jennifer up in West Branch. Go ahead, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I originally called because the Republican guy really made me mad. But you know what? But actually, I wanted to talk about something else now. I have a mystery. I don't understand why Michigan has, like, two different economies in it. I have to drive all the way down from West Branch to Sterling Heights to work.
Okay.
Because the wage scale is so, it's just so vast. I make $25 an hour down in Sterling Heights. And the same company, it's the same exact company as 5 miles down the street from my house in West Branch, only they pay $14.75 an hour. Why does that happen? I don't understand it. And the whole economy up north is like that. And well, I just, they get the same, it's a health care facility, and they get the same reimbursement off insurance that everybody else does downstate.
Well, it's all the traffic will bear, in a way. Listen, you know, I go on every once in a while this sort of technical explanation of wages. You have what you call fixed capital for a business. You have fixed capital, you have variable capital. And so the fixed capital is what they have to pay for the building, the machinery, and stuff like that. The variable capital is us. They buy our labor. And if they can, if they're forced, like, for instance, to pay a higher price for it because we unionize or there's competition in a particular area where they have to pay more to get you to come down there, then they're going to pay it. But if they can pay people $3 an hour in a maquiladores factory on the border of Mexico and Texas or Arizona, they'll do that. So what the owners are always trying to do is they're trying to drive down their prices so they'll make more money, and our labor is sold at a price. So we're essentially objects of the economy, and if they can get us for cheap, they do it. That's why they struggle so hard to you know, stop people from unionizing, for instance.
Well, I just want to say, too, even on $25 an hour, I have four kids. My husband, he's in school. And I'm a nurse. I have a house, but we have no car payments. We drive a 92 Caprice with 240,000 miles on it.
Right.
I can barely support us as it is unless he's, you know, until he gets out of school. But, I mean, they're talking about minimum wage. Even on $25 an hour, I can't support my family barely. So.
Well, yeah. How many kids do you have?
I have four, and luckily my mom actually has two of them living with her because I can't support everybody on what I make.
Well, and I'll tell you, I think that there are people that are probably thinking, Jennifer, man, I was making $25 an hour. It would be amazing.
They just don't understand.
Yeah. Let me get some of these final calls. Thank you very much. Let's see. Here's Chris in Dearborn. What's happening, Chris?
Chris, I got to know what you're talking about when you say global warming.
What do you mean?
You're telling me.
Well,
do we have to start at the beginning?
No,
or?
Well, just real quickly, tens of thousands of climatologists and other scientists say that human activity, particularly burning fossil fuels, is beginning to raise the overall temperature of the Earth, and if it's not stopped, dire consequences are going to occur. That's what global warming is.
I gotta know where you got that information.
Well,
what scientists.
It was just the latest one. One of the dozens and dozens and dozens of them are in the United Nations study. I'm trying to look for what this is called, the IPCC, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and this has been done by, the 2,500 scientists that give their best prediction. What's up? I only got a little bit of time. What's your deal with it?
Well, sir, I'm just saying, we got Jupiter, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, all their temperatures are rising right now, and there's not a single car driving on any of those things. I mean, it's the sun's getting hotter, man. It's not, human activities aren't causing nothing.
Okay. Well,
I thought Pluto wasn't even a planet anymore, right?
I think it does have to do with Uranus, actually. So thank you very much.
No, you did not.
Well,
that is quite a planet.
Yeah. Here's Mark from Hazel Park. That rhymes. Go ahead, Mark from Hazel Park.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great. Give me a quick one, though. We're almost out of time.
Quick. The guy that just called?
Yeah.
All right. How's this for global warming? Like all these tankers are dumping their ballast in our lake.
Oh, great.
Causing viruses in the fish that are...
That we're eating?
Eyes bleed.
Yeah.
I don't know. Every time I catch a virus, I feel like I'm burning up.
Well, there you go. Well, there's,
I mean, there's
Mark warming.
Look at it, but also, remember when Halliburton was in that big scam with the oil and gas from Kuwait into Iraq? They were making $2 or $3 a gallon.
Oh, yeah. They were screwing us big time.
Well, think about it. They're getting it for a quarter in Kuwait. Why aren't we getting it for a quarter in Kuwait? We're paying $3 a gallon, which is causing the auto industry to die, which is the last stronghold of union labor.
Yeah, well, maybe there's something behind that. All right, thank you very much. Got to get some final calls in here. I want to see if I can get everybody. It's Scott from Weston. You know, Scott, we can never do anything simply. It just occurred to me. So my apologies. I know you're a longtime caller and listener. Let me see if I can get you in. But I want to get Jerry in St. Clair Shores. And Jerry, just got about a minute or so go ahead.
Yeah, real quick about that guy earlier who said we were a generous nation. I don't understand how we can spend more than the rest of the world combined on our military and still be unable to provide public health insurance for our own people and be called a generous nation.
Thank you.
Also, a $100 billion increase in the war in Iraq, when if you took $100 billion and divided it by 50 states, $2 billion per state would not only wipe out Michigan's $940 million debt, we'd have $1 billion left over to give everyone a college education. So I think people really have to pay closer attention to the numbers and try to comprehend what the hell these people are trying to do to us.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you go to my website, there's a little a link to where our tax money goes. It ain't going to the right place. It ain't going to us. It's going to Bushko's rich friends, which is why I say we are being ruled by a racket, not a government. All right. Thank you for being our last caller. Thanks to Al Slayer for answering our phones. Jalene Jordan.
Always.
Always a pleasure doing the show with you. Yes. Stay tuned. I've got an interview with Jonathan Cohn. He's written a book called Sick. It's about our so-called healthcare system and the crisis, actually, it's facing. Remember, again, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. You can go to MySpace. Don't tell me, MySpace.com, Night Call Detroit. Thank you, Jalene.
Thank you, Peter.
And thanks to all of you for listening and calling, and we'll talk again next week.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. Well, I think everyone in this country has a full appreciation of the crisis of health care. It's something that so many of us, we experience it directly. If we are lucky enough to not experience it directly, then we read about health costs just eating up everything from pensions to state budgets. Joining me is someone who has done a lot of work to look at this problem and doing it in terms of how it impacts on individuals. The book is called Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. The author is Jonathan Cohn, and he's a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. He's written about national politics, their impact on American communities for the past decade. He's also a contributing editor at the American Prospect and a senior fellow at the think tank Demos. He's been a media fellow with the Kaiser Family Foundation. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Slate, the Washington Monthly. And he's a neighbor of ours. He's a graduate of Harvard, lives now in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Jonathan Cohn, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
I was just laughing because we were talking about taping and when you made a mistake in speaking of recutting it. There, we'll leave that in. Well, tell me about your book, Sick. I suspect that it at least has a double meaning.
It does. Sick, actually, I think it has a triple meaning. I like to think it. Sick is obviously referring to the people in this book. I wanted to write a book that explained how our healthcare system works, or actually how it doesn't work, how this system came to be and why we're having all these problems now. But I wanted to write a book that was both substantive and had statistics and had real history in it. But at the same time, I wanted to bring this home to people. I didn't want this to be some distant problem that they thought of as somebody else's. I wanted them to experience it for themselves. So the focus of the book is really these eight individuals whose stories I tell, one in each chapter, and each person is from a different part of the country. And so Sick refers, first of all of them have some kind of medical issue or medical crisis they have to deal with, and that sort of sets up the story. Sick also refers to the fact that the health insurance system upon which they're relying to give them access to medical care isn't working very well, so that system is sick. And then I guess you could say sick is also, and it's a sort of slang sense of, well, you know, this is really sick that we let this happen to people, because as I follow these stories, a lot of them run up against some pretty brutal consequences. And that's really what the story, the book is about. It's about what happens to you when you lose access to medical care. How does this upend your life? And then, well, why is this happening and what can we do about it?
Well, how does one go about this? I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, to have a book, maybe for someone like myself who wants background information and stats and all that, and there is a lot of very, very just startling facts in your book, Sick. But if someone said to me, go find eight people, particularly scattered around the country, to talk about that, exemplified this, that illustrated it, I would be at a loss. How did you contact these people?
That was the hardest part of the book. It was hard, first of all, you can't just stand on a street corner and walk up to people and say, excuse me, have you had a problem affording medical care? I know you can't do that because actually at one point I tried to do something quite like that. I was in Los Angeles, and of course Los Angeles is ground zero for our healthcare problems. They have the most uninsured people as a percentage of the population, I think, of any city in the country. Okay. And it is literally true that if you stand on a street corner in Los Angeles and approach people who are not wearing office clothing, your chances are better than not. You'll very quickly come across someone who's uninsured. So I actually went into office buildings and handed out letters to security guards and people who I thought might not have insurance. I actually got a few interviews that way, but it didn't in the end get me my story. And of course, finding stories that where people will open up to you and tell you what they're doing, stories that not only offer a window into the healthcare system, but actually have the architecture of a good narrative. So yeah, I really wanted this to be something that people could read. I wanted my readers to get to know these people and jump into their lives. So I ended up, I found everybody in the book in a different way. You know, one or two were people who had been written about in a local newspaper article. And I saw, and I'm doing my background research, I kind of clipped. I said, oh, this is an interesting person. I'm going to get in touch with this person. And they had an interesting story to tell. One or two people I found through organizations that were working one way or another with the uninsured. Although, more often than not, that was introduced. I found people via word of mouth that way. So, in other words, a group introduced me to someone. The people the group introduced me to someone, well, they didn't quite work for the story, but they knew somebody who did. And then a lot of the people I found through clinics, hospitals, and doctors, and I'd come to them and I'd say, look, I'm interested in, I want to understand what you see in your practice every day and what kind of problems, particularly for clinics that end up treating people who don't have health insurance or don't have adequate health insurance. What kind of problems do you see? And I get a sort of broad picture from that. And then I say, well, are there any patients in particular you could introduce me to? And, of course, there's privacy rules and such, so it's, you have to be careful how you do this. But typically what I would do is I would say, could you please pass along my information to these people? And if they're willing to talk to me, we can arrange a meeting. And, you know, I still remember one of the – it was a wonderful experience getting to meet all these people. And people are so – I'm almost in awe of their abilities to talk about this – some incredibly tragic and personal circumstances for no one got any compensation for sitting down with me to talk about this. This was simply so other people could learn. And the people, the subjects of these chapters spent many, many hours with me over days and weeks telling me their story and letting me back check the facts of their story and such. And it always impressed me. I remember one in particular when I was in Tennessee in this little clinic in rural Tennessee. And, you know, there's a woman who runs a clinic and, you know, you wonder if she's some kind of angel sent down from heaven because she's sort of putting together this clinic with no money. You know, the state program for the indigent is falling apart, and she's, you know, on the phone one minute with the drug companies begging them to give her extra supplies. And, you know, she said, oh, come on in. And she let me sit there for a while, and you know, and I ended up, through one of her patients, meeting somebody who ended up being the subject of one of the chapters in the book.
Mm-hmm. In SICK, these people come alive, as you're indicating. And you talk a lot about the changes in the healthcare system, but it's also both how we perceive of our medical system. It wasn't so long ago that people said we have the best medical system in the world, that because people in the United States think we have the best everything. Although I think that's beginning to fray around the edges. But and I would have thought that if you would have tried to do this 10, 15, 20 years ago, that people almost would have been too embarrassed to speak to you. Did you get the sense that people were just seeing this as an individual tragedy, or that they themselves, as I said, your book illustrated the problem? Did you get the sense that they felt that they were that there were other people similarly situated to them, and they wanted to tell the story for everyone?
I think the people who experienced these problems definitely did. I mean, everyone seemed to have a certain self-awareness about them, and a lot of them, frankly, seemed quite motivated to spread the word. I mean, again, they had, you know, no reason to talk to me other than the benefit of society, if you will. And several people told me, they said, look, I would like people to learn from my experience. I don't want other people to go through what I had to go through. I don't, however, know. I think that's true of the people who go through this. I don't think it's so true of the rest of the American public. And I think that's a big reason why I wrote this book. I think, you know, you can take polls now. There was a poll recently out asking people, do you support universal health insurance? Would you pay higher taxes to get it? And 61% of the country said yes. This made a big splash in the newspapers. Wow, 61% of America says they will pay higher taxes to get universal health care. Well, not to be pessimistic about this, because I, as I make clear in the book, I think universal health care would be a great thing. This book is a brief in a lot of ways for universal health care. But I can show you the poll in 1991, same polling firm, NY, that did the New York Times CBS poll. It's the same question. Same result, but it's actually higher by 1 point. It was 62% back then. And, you know, I think in general, when you go through this, you realize...
Well, when was it at a low point? I mean, I know, like, the American Medical Association was able to put into our lexicon, our political lexicon, the phrase socialized medicine. So people, you know, you'd say, how about university? Socialized medicine. You were somehow thrown into a bag with commies. Was there a point where it was at a low ebb?
Well, I know, and it's funny, that word goes all the way back to the 30s and 20s when our insurance is. I mean, one of the stunning things I learned in researching this history is that, we are repeating the same drama over and over again. We've had several debates about health care reform in this country, and every time there's somebody promoting universal health care, and every time the opponents change over time. Originally, it was more the doctors. Nowadays, it's less the doctors and more other interest groups, but you hear the same arguments about socialized medicine and such. And, you know, if you look at the polls, enthusiasm for universal health care dipped after the fight over the Clinton health care plan. People really, I like to say that it wasn't so much a change in public opinion as the debate went forward, we got deeper into public opinion. And people were a lot more ambivalent back then. And I think they are still ambivalent today. I mean, I think most people intellectually will say, yeah, we don't have such a great healthcare system, but, you know, I'm all right. I have insurance. This isn't going to happen to me. And you know what, if I we'd have some universal system, I'm going to wait in line for my treatments, and I can't get the good medical care I need. I don't really want that. You know, things are not so bad. We'll just keep things the way we are.
Well, I have to say that there is a streak of cynicism in me. I mean, I advocate, obviously, obviously for people that have heard me talk before, a universal health care system here in the United States. But unless it was done in the most incredibly innovative manner, it would probably be a bureaucratic nightmare here. I mean, because you'd have to graft onto this already extraordinarily expensive and bureaucratic system a layer of government administration. So it would almost, in fact, maybe we're even getting towards the end of the book, you know, rather than the beginning and the middle of Sick by Jonathan Cohn. That is, what sort of system do you have that would actually improve health care for all of us without it being, as I said, a bureaucratic nightmare?
Well, this is a really interesting tension that comes up, and this is the debate we're going to be having, I think, in the next 2 years as we lead up to the next presidential election, and already you're seeing politicians come out with plans for universal health care. There is a tension here. On the one hand, the simplest solution in one sense of the least change from what we have now is some kind of patchwork where basically we plug the holes in the system and the government finds a way to get insurance to people who don't have it. And this is really the direction we've been going in for a while in terms of American politics. These are the plans you mostly hear from American politicians. And the catch is we do have a really backward system right now. It's incredibly dysfunctional. So I don't know that it would make it worse to fill in the holes. I don't think the system would get worse. I think there would be some improvements. But if you don't really radically overhaul the entire healthcare system, you will end up with a system that's better than what we have now and that everybody would be covered, but you'll be left with a lot of the inefficiencies, a lot of the waste. And when you say inefficiency, that doesn't just make it more expensive for all of us, but, you know, it's an everyday hassle thing. You know, the other day we live in Ann Arbor, and we have pretty good health insurance, and we went to Walgreens to go fill a prescription, and we spent an hour there because there was some confusion about the insurance card, which, you know, that's going to happen when you have 30,000 different health insurance plans, and Walgreens has to figure out how to charge you, and someone's name is spelled wrong. And that was an hour of lost productivity for me. It was an hour of lost productivity for the clerk at the pharmacy, all the people who had to wait. And that is just incredibly wasteful. Now, ironically, the more radical changes, which sound bigger, but, you know, if you go to a more radical change, in other words, if you really reinvent the healthcare system top to bottom, you can get a system that's a lot simpler, and there is a lot to be said for it. I mean, we can get this later, but I talk in my book about France, for example, which is more of what you would call a single-payer health care system. And you don't hear a lot about that in American politics because it's considered politically less realistic and it's considered a more sweeping change. But at least on paper, it sure looks a lot more efficient.
The book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Jonathan Cohn is my guest here in the studio with me. I'm Peter Werby. It's published by HarperCollins. And before we go too much further, because sometimes I know folks are just driving in their car and they've got to get out, I want to alert you to appearances of Jonathan Cohn in our area. He's going to be at the Shame and Drum Bookshop this Tuesday, April 10th. And that's at 311 South State Street in Ann Arbor, where I just saw Mike Farrell. You may remember I announced that. And also, you have an appearance in May in the area as well?
Early May at one of the border stores in Ann Arbor, I think the one in Arborland.
Okay. If you check my website, I'll get Jonathan to alert me to that. I'll put that on my website calendar, which is Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. You can also go to the book's website, sickthebook.com. Now, as I said, this is the healthcare crisis. It's interesting. It's being almost defined universally as a crisis, has generated a lot of conversation, a lot of political advocacy. And there's been just one more letter. We have our friend from Flint, Michael Moore, has a book, film, Sicko, coming out. So this is, I don't hear the opposition. It's like everyone almost to a person, including the president, says that we have problems and there has to be some alterations made, some new programs put into place. So that would seem to be the political and social context for which we can make some alterations.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question. Well, I shouldn't say no question. Politics is unpredictable. You know, anything can happen in the next 2 years. But as things stand, this is the number one domestic policy issue of the coming presidential election. And I think you can see that not only the fact that we have one presidential candidate, John Edwards, who has put out a very detailed an impressive plan for universal health care. We have the other two leading contenders, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, have both pledged themselves. And, you know, whether they come out with a plan or a set of principles, they are going to make this part of their running platform. And even on the Republican side, you know, we have Mitt Romney, who was the governor of Massachusetts and, of course, native of Michigan, who signed a universal health care law into Massachusetts and boasted this as part of his campaign and has said he would try to do something like that nationally. Out in California, we have Arnold Schwarzenegger trying to do the same thing. That's two very prominent Republicans. And we have business leaders talking about this. Now, the cautionary note on this is that if you go back to 1991 and 1992, you will also find Republicans talking about universal health care, and you will find business leaders saying they think universal health care is a good idea. So you have to pay attention to how committed they are and what exactly they mean when they say universal health care.
Well, we, of course, there's a problem with the finances of this country. We've been driven into debt. We're already a debtor, and it's usually not good for debtors, whether it's an individual with who's maxed out on their credit card or a country like ours that's deeply in hock to foreign banks to take on a massive multi-billion dollar program. I mean, I would say we don't have the money to do a – I mean, we do, but the priorities are wrong. And like we were saying earlier, you mentioned that study that said 61% of us would be willing to pay more taxes. I'm in the 39%. I mean, the money is already there. The average person doesn't have to put up more money. We just have to redirect the money that's already gone or already taken from us, in my estimation. So is that a question? Let me see. Did you?
Well, I mean,
can we afford it? Is there money there?
Yes, we can afford it. I think it's a question of how we afford it. I mean, I think it's important to look at all the money we spend on healthcare as one basket. And in the process of going to a universal healthcare system, there will almost surely be higher taxes because you're going to be asking the government to do something it's not doing. It may be a lot, it may be a little, but there will be more taxes. But keep in mind that that's sort of part of the ledger. You know, it's like looking at just the losses or the profit, the revenues. The other side of the ledger is that you'll be spending less somewhere else. So, you know, this has been in California. Arnold Schwarzenegger has talked about what he calls the hidden tax. This is how he justifies his health care plan. He says, look, my private insurance right now pays for the cost of the uninsured, because when somebody who's uninsured shows up in an emergency room, somebody has to pay for that. And eventually that will get passed along to me as a higher private insurance premium. So if I now take care of these uninsured people directly, and ideally, over the long term, I get them preventative care so they don't end up in the emergency room. Well, I'm probably going to actually save a little money. So, yes, I'm going to spend a little extra tax money on them, getting them that preventative care. But at the same time, my private insurance bill is going to come down. And I think most people would agree that certainly over the long term, this is the only way to spend less money. In fact, I recently wrote a story about Steve Bird, who's the head of Safeway. And he's nobody would accuse Steve Bird of having a bleeding heart. He's the guy who led the grocery stores in California into the big fight with their unions demanding they take lesser health benefits. He has become evangelical about universal health care basically because he thinks it's the only way to get down costs. So I think most people would agree that in the long term, as a whole, we will spend less on universal health care than we will on our current system. You may pay more in taxes, but that will be more than offset for the average American by the fact that you'll have lower health insurance premiums and higher wages. You know, there's one proposal floating out there by an economist at Stanford who's one of the most respected economists in the country named Victor Fuchs, and he did it along with a guy named Ezekiel Emanuel. And the two of them came up with a plan, and they said to finance their plan, it was like a voucher system, they called it, that they would have what would be, in effect, what's called a value-added tax. It would basically raise prices by 10 to 12% at a one-time price raise. You say, oh, my God, I'm going to start paying 10% more for my consumer goods. They said, yeah, but you know what? Your wages are going to go up, too, by a lot. And most Americans will actually see their net income, the net money in their wallet, go up at the end of the day when this is all done. Now, again, there's whether that happens right away, it takes a little time, it's hard to say. But I think in general, keep in mind that when you hear politicians talk about higher taxes to pay for universal health care, and again, John Edwards, to his credit, has done that quite forthrightly, that the second half of that is, higher taxes, but you're also going to get more higher wages. And think about what you're going to gain from this before you decide that you don't want to pay higher taxes.
Let's skip back a little and get a little historic view on the situation here. It's almost a matter, and people were often shocked to say, several years ago to learn the United States was the only industrialized country without a national health program. But how did that happen historically? Because some of the, I think some of the countries, what, go back in the 1890s almost.
Well, social insurance sort of has its origins in Germany and to some extent Scandinavia right around the turn of the 20th century. And the fork in the road for the United States really happens in the 1920s. That's really the point at which medical care becomes so expensive for the first time that lots of people can't afford it. And prior to that, you know, people worried about the financial effects of illness, but mostly they were worried about the fact that if you got sick, you couldn't work, so you lost your wages. And that was because medical care wasn't very good. I mean, it wasn't very good. You didn't pay a lot for it. Well, starting in the 20s, now medicine becomes good. Great, now hospitals can cure people. The problem is that now it's very expensive. You have lots of people who can't afford it. And there is a discussion in this country, how should we pay for it? And everybody realizes you need some kind of insurance model where basically people who are healthy, in effect, are paying for the cost of those few people who are sick. Everyone's paying into one pool, and the money is distributed. And the question is how you do that. Now, every developed nation in the world reaches this point. Every other one of them eventually goes to a universal healthcare system. They say, gee, the best, most efficient way to do this is to have everybody together paying into one common pool so that we spread the cost of illness across all of society. Now, in the United States, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt thinks about adding this to the Social Security Act. And we are told by historians that he basically is afraid that the opposition from state medical societies and other opponents of universal health care who don't like it because it might interfere with their medical practices or they might hold down their incomes or it might just philosophically they're against government intruding in the private sector. These opponents, he's worried, will be so powerful and so hostile to universal health care, they will manage to sink the whole Social Security Act. And he's not willing to gamble on that. So he doesn't include it. And basically, ever since that day, we've kind of gone down this path, and it's become harder and harder to dislodge the system that's grown up on its own in the absence of a universal system.
Well, a lot of the organized opposition certainly has been from what's called the business class, and yet now, I mean, it would seem to me that businesses, as you indicated, the guy with the supermarkets in California, that they would be the biggest proponents of it. I mean, they are corporations, businesses, even small ones, are being swamped by medical costs. Are they changing?
They are. It's hard to know how much. I mean, obviously, here in Michigan, for example, you have the auto industry, and they've been in desperate straits for a while now. I mean, if you live in Michigan, you've heard the stories. You know, was it $1,500 per car that GM spends on its health benefits for its workers? It is a burden they carry around. And the auto industry and the steel industry and the heavily unionized companies, the big manufacturing companies that really invented this system in the 50s, I mean, they're the ones who really cemented this system in place. Well, they're really struggling now to the extent that they're still around, right? I mean, a lot of the steel companies just are gone now. So they've been interested in universal health care for a while, and they've been basically friendly to it. What's changing now is that you see a broader array of businesses. Again, the supermarkets, you know, they don't have the same legacy issues. They don't have all these retirees who have very expensive bills, but they are a low-margin business. So even a small change in their health benefit costs really affects them. That's why you see the supermarket chains. Also, in the case of the supermarkets, they're feeling the competition from competitors here in the United States who don't pay their workers as much or give their workers as much health insurance. And really, I'm talking about Walmart now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a sense on the part of a lot of businesses, there's two things. Number one, they would like a level playing field. You know, they don't want to be if a business for whatever reason has decided to give its workers generous health insurance, it then doesn't want to suffer competitively because a new business comes in and doesn't. And increasingly also, I think with globalization, you see more and more businesses that are, you know, they operate in countries where they have universal health care, and it's not this crazy thing, and it doesn't affect the way they operate business. They say, you know, this isn't so bad. So I think that's softening the traditional opposition. On the other hand, historically, you could make the case that from the get-go, business would have been better off without doing, you know, and that the problem has always been ideology has trumped practicality. I mean, if your business in general is very suspicious of the government, they protect their prerogatives, and they don't want to give it up.
Jonathan Cohn, about 30 seconds probably for a complicated answer. Is it going to happen?
I don't know yet. What I always say is that I think whether universal health care succeeds, that will be determined not after the next president is elected, but before. It's really a matter of whether the proponents of universal health care can generate enough political momentum going into the next presidential election that when the backlash and the opposition really kicks in, there's enough to carry it through.
The book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. My guest has been Jonathan Cohn. And, I've got to remind people that Jonathan Cohn is going to be speaking this Tuesday, April 10th, 7 p.m. at the Shame and Drum Bookshop. That's at 311 South State Street. And you can go to his website for the book, sickthebook.com. There'll be a link on my site, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. Jonathan Cohn, thanks for coming into the studio and being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much.
Listening WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. As we record this interview, the heat index over 100. It's probably all going to be forgotten in a few days, going to drop down to 75 or 80. But this portends something. And when I think about global warming issues, when I think about energy issues, I think about Harvey Wasserman, an old friend, an activist, an author, and someone who we can depend on to give us good information. Harvey Wasserman in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, it's great to talk to you again.
I just want to give people, just because you're my old pal, they need a little more of this. I'm going to read just a couple lines from your biography here. Harvey Wasserman is a world-renowned expert on utility deregulation, atomic power, and renewable alternatives. And I like this. Since 1973, Harvey coined the phrase, no nukes. You did? I didn't know that.
I did indeed. Well, it's proof if you put a monkey in a room long enough with a typewriter, something good will come out. So.
And he's led the charge against nuclear power for such groups as Greenpeace. I think that's where I met you. And Musicians United for Safe Energy. Was that big concert with Jackson Browne and everything?
Yeah, there were five concerts in Madison Square Garden in 1979, September. It was a giant sleep deprivation project. And we had Jackson Browne, Bonnie Raitt, Graham Nash, CSN, James Taylor, Carly Simon, and, of course, Bruce Springsteen did two nights for us, so it was really great.
Sure, and you were there, all of them, huh?
Oh, yeah, believe me. I stood about 20 feet from Bruce Springsteen for two consecutive nights while he played for about 3 hours a night. It was fabulous. I think it was his 30th birthday, actually.
That's a while ago now, isn't it?
It was.
Also, Harvey is the senior editor of freepress.org, another highly recommended site, freepress.org. And he's got 8 books out, including a how-to guide for farmers and investors building their own wind farms, which I'd like to talk about. The Last Energy War, published by Seven Stories Press, which we interviewed Harvey about, which is an analysis of the disaster of electric utility deregulation in California. Other books are George W. Bush versus the Superpower of Peace, that's We the People. And the latest book, brand new, at least a new edition, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth AD 2030, and that's right, just new out again, a new version?
Yeah, so what's happening is I've jumped into the world of self-publishing, which I love, and I published a small edition of Solartopia, and then all these solar experts, which I wanted to do, they critiqued it, and I changed things, and so now Solartopia is out there. It's available at my website, harveywasserman.com, and I'm taking suggestions, and I'm going to do one more version, which will be published on Earth Day in 2007, and it's the first envisioning of what the world could look like and had better look like, actually, after a solar revolution, a revolution in solar energy.
Yeah, and harveywasserman.com. Last name is spelled W-A-S-S-E-R-M-A-N.
One N, yeah.
.com. And I'll have a link on my site, peterwerbe.com. W-E-R-B-E. We were talking before. It doesn't mean just water man?
Yeah.
It does.
Water man, actually, the name Wasserman in German is Aquarian. If you look at the astrological charts, when they get to whatever they call Aquarius, it's Wasserman. So there you go.
And mine,
we're in the age of Wasserman.
Yeah, that's right. Mine is Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, which means advertising in German. Radio advertising is Werbefunken. Why are we taking up? I'm doing this, taking up this important time with this nonsense. Let's get down to it. Here, an article in the New York Times today: electrical use hits new highs in much of U.S. We've got this almost global heat wave, and experts say demand is rising faster than the ability to meet it, which could, over the long run, pose the risk of both local and regional failures. Well, and there's still some people that say there's not global warming, right?
Yeah, 3 or 4. Well, actually, I had a very revealing moment. I was stuck in an airport and went to the bookstore and, dare I say, I picked up a book by Ann Coulter. And I'm reading there, and she's got this ridiculous denunciation of global warming, completely misinformed, ill-informed, mean-spirited, who would have guessed. And then the next chapter is a denunciation of Darwin's theory of evolution. I thought, well, there must be a pattern here. But no serious climate scientists doubt anymore, as far as I'm concerned, the theory of global warming. You can find a few. I bet half of them are fundamentalist Christians who have this, you know, anti-Darwinian thing, and the other half were for coal companies. But, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that the level of CO2 in the atmosphere has risen in recent years and is a record highs, at least that we know of. And simultaneously, of course, the weather has gone nuts.
If there's no question, in my mind, there isn't from all the scientific evidence I've seen and the preponderance of climatologists and environmental scientists and what have you, that we are facing global warming, why then is there still this presentation in the media of he said, she said? So there's this one guy, Michael, what the hell is his name, at the University of Virginia, just saw in the New York Times he'd just gotten $150,000 to continue his research from utility companies, and he is quoted, I mean, they'll quote Harvey Wasserman, you, and then they'll say, well, we better get the opposing point of view.
Right. You know, it's like opposing points of view on the Holocaust. I mean, you know, it's beyond any scientific doubt that we have completely messed up the weather patterns. And one of the reasons some people have a hard time with it is because it's not just global warming. Global warming is really a misnomer. It's climate chaos. You know, we've induced record droughts, record floods, record rainfall, record cold spells, record hot spells. It's just we've created total chaos with our meteorological systems and thus with our life support systems. And it's a nightmare, and we're in very serious trouble.
Well, one thing I said at the introduction is the heat index is over 100 for the second day in a row here in the Detroit area.
Right.
And when tomorrow it'll be 75 to 80, and everyone will probably forget it. But I do remember, and here's one of the arguments that the few people left that say this is just a hot summer. 1988 in Detroit was miserable. A few days over 100, 90s all the time. So they say, hey, 18 years ago, it was a lot hotter. You know what?
I don't know if you've seen the Al Gore movie, Inconvenient Truth, but almost every successive year now since the 1980s has been the hottest on record, including last year. And, the cumulative temperature of the Earth. And it just absolutely adds up and gets worse and worse. The irony is the theory of global warming does not even have to be true for us to want to do what it will take to solve the problem.
That's very interesting. Go ahead. Yeah.
Because renewable energy is so cheap now and so readily available and so environmentally clean and such a great job creator that we should be going solar anyway, even if global warming wasn't even a problem. Because this is the best stuff. I mean, and, we are definitely running out of natural gas. There's, thousands of natural gas generators that were built that will never be used because gas has gotten too expensive. There are, oil, we all know what oil is about. We're in a war for one right now. Coal is plentiful to a certain extent, but the cheapest coal is running out, and miners get killed, and there's acid rain and all this other stuff. And nuclear power, forget it. Nuclear power is never going to work. It's too expensive, too complicated, too dangerous. So, on the other hand, wind power is booming. It's extremely well-proven. It's ridiculously cheap, tremendously profitable for those who invest in it, limitless possibilities, and tremendous job creator. So we have wind power, then we have solar. You have the wonderful Ovonix factories in the Troy area. Photovoltaic cells translate sunlight directly to electricity. You have solar water heating. It's a booming industry, and it's cheap.
Harvey Wasserman, I overall agree with you, but let me play the devil's advocate, which some of my listeners think I am in any event. Essentially, you're still talking about a footnote of the economy. When we look at the swollen profits of BP and ExxonMobil and the rest of them, Shell, that have just come in with 40% above last quarter, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of profits.
Right out of our pocket.
Well, yeah, that's our money, unless it's, let me not go too far afield. So the point being is that when you have those gigantic economic forces of oil and other fossil fuel industries that have a willing and compliant representative sitting at the highest political office, it becomes a little difficult to think about that we're going to move into something nice and clean.
Well, except that this stuff is incredibly profitable. The biggest maker of photovoltaic cells in the world is British Petroleum.
Really?
And they are not, I will not say that they are sitting on it and trying to kill it at this point. That may have happened a decade or two ago, but the handwriting's on the wall. This stuff is the future. There is not an infinite supply of oil. There is certainly not of gas. Coal, like I say, is problematic, and nuclear power, forget it. Where else are they going to go? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, renewables is no longer the alternative fuel. It's coal, oil, nukes, and gas, which I call in Solartopia King Kong, although King Kong in the movies was a lot more sympathetic character. So, these are the fuels of the past. Sun, wind, biofuels. Biofuels are a very big deal. Right now we're getting ethanol from corn and diesel from soy, but that's not going to last. You do not use perennial food crops for fuel. And there's some critiques about how ethanol made with corn is not really a net energy producer. And there is some credibility to that. I mean, there are some legitimate questions about ethanol, corn-based ethanol.
Being a net.
Right.
Because everything you got to do to grow it.
Right.
Yeah.
And but and soy diesel, actually, we don't see those critiques. It seems pretty well established. But, you know, in the long term, ethanol is going to be made with switchgrass, with poplar trees, with Jerusalem artichoke, and that four-letter word, hemp. I mean, it's going to be easy to grow perennials that you don't eat. Same with diesel. Diesel is now being made with soybeans. It still actually seems to be fairly profitable and, you know, a net energy producer. But in the long term, diesel is going to be made with vegetable oils. The diesel engine was originally designed to run on vegetable oils. And, you know, so there's really no question that the future is with renewables. Now, in Solartopia, I posit a world by 2030 that is 100% renewables. And there are those who say that's completely unrealistic and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL.US, for those of you who are interested in their website, has issued a draft study, which they then recalled, saying that 100% of America's electricity could be supplied with renewables by 2020. Huh. That's actually 10 years ahead of my projections in Solartopia of 2030. Now, they said, oh, well, we overstated them, blah, blah, blah. We're looking at it again. But the fact is that we do have the technology. We do not need another Manhattan Project for renewables. This stuff has all been invented. It's out there. It's profitable. What we need is the subsidies on coal, oil, nukes, and gas to be taken away. I mean, I'm actually a free market Milton Friedman guy when it comes to energy, because the renewables are cheaper and the coal, oil, nukes, and gas are being propped up by government subsidies.
Well, Harvey Wasserman, you really answered my question. I've heard it said that renewables and solar power and wind power does not have the capacity to supply the world's energy needs.
It's utterly false.
Okay.
It's utterly false. There's sufficient wind potential in Kansas, North Dakota, and West Texas alone to supply 100% of the nation's electricity with available windmills. You don't have to invent new wind turbines to do this, because the ones we got are so big and so cost-effective that it could be done.
Gee, where would we get the money? Maybe, how about the military budget?
Well, you know,
we wouldn't have to fight any more wars.
Well, let me tell you a little story. Columbus, Ohio has no mass transit. You know, we have buses. There's no light rail here. This city is choking on traffic. So the Central Ohio Transit Authority put out a study for a rail-based mass transit system, and they came back and said, well, it costs about $500 million. And the federal government says, no, it's too expensive. However, the federal government is now spending $8 billion a month in Iraq. So for 1/16 of what we're spending in Iraq in 1 month, we could have had a light rail system in the city, and the city will not survive without a light rail system. Buses are not going to do it. And what's killing American cities and will kill us in the future is a lack of mass transit. And yet, we can't do it because of our war for oil in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Besides your book, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030, you've also written a how-to guide for farmers and investors building their own wind farms. And I just saw in the New York Times today that Vail Resorts, the big Colorado ski and recreation company, says it's going to make a huge investment in wind power. And yet you find increasingly objections, not only from local homeowners on places like the East Coast and resort areas, but also from some environmentalists who say those big windmills chew up birds.
Yeah, you know, this bird thing is nonsense. I mean, there is one wind farm in Altamont Pass, California, one of the early wind farms, and they set up these towers. They're lattice work towers. They're erector set towers, and the birds perch on them, and they see prey on the ground, and, you know, they dive, and they get clunked by the blades. So you know what the solution is? You build towers that are tubular, where the birds can't perch, and then it doesn't happen anymore. I mean, you know, there are some places where windmills could do harm to birds. We do have environmental impact statements that watch out for that. We've also been blindsided. There was a wind farm built in West Virginia that has been killing some bats. So this is the problem. However, a billion birds a year are killed by cats. and hundreds of thousands by cars, hundreds of thousands by guy wires on towers, and hundreds of thousands on buildings with glass windows. The bird kill at wind farms is virtually insignificant. My buddy Dan Jewell in Minnesota owns 17 big windmills. He's had them up for 7 years. He's never had a single bird kill. I visited the windmill at Hull, Massachusetts, which is on the water in a schoolyard just south of Boston. The thing is surrounded, swarmed over by seagulls, never a dead one. You know, I mean, these days, these machines are so big and so slow that it takes a really suicidal bird to get clunked by a windmill.
You know? Anyway, go back with the cat figure, though. Did you say billion?
Yeah, as many as a billion. It's a huge number.
It can't
domestic
be.
Cats, feral cats.
It can't
you know,
be
people
that
really
big.
Want to be worried about birds. They should declaw their cats.
I know, but Harvey, it couldn't be a billion birds by
how
cat.
Many cats do you think are out there?
I don't know. Not a billion.
Well, it doesn't take a billion birds.
Say they each kill four. There has to be 200.
You got it. Yeah, they have a quota enforced with ration stamps for cats.
Well, this is going back to the old stuff, but I remember I did want to get your opinion on this. Today, or I guess it was yesterday, the Senate voted to open up 8.3 million acres of federal waters to Central Gulf of Mexico oil and gas drilling. What's your sense of that?
Completely unnecessary. It shouldn't happen. It really should not happen. I mean, we need to keep our waters clean, and you know, we don't need to be drilling offshore. The fossil fuels are done. We don't have the Earth no longer has the carrying capacity for us to be burning fossil fuels. It's just got to stop.
You know, and take this in the right spirit. I'm still fearful. I'm still fearful of the elites that control things, whose visions. Well, they were in the 20th century. They're actually going back to the 19th century now. But there is a spirit that you have that's very attractive. But what we and I'm not telling you anything you don't know is the social and political forces behind what's possible. I mean, these people could run us right into the ground environmentally or militarily before we could get those towers up.
Well, they're doing it, but actually, there's a couple things working. First of all, they're out of gas. Natural gas is just, you know, really going. In fact, the major source of new natural gas is going to be dump sites. You know, 6,000 or 7,000 urban dumps around the country that are going to be our next big source of methane. But you know, oil has all its problems, as we know, and the cheap oil is gone. I mean, you know, they want to drill here, they want to drill there. It's not cheap. And, you know, coal has tremendous problems, as we know. Nuclear power doesn't work. It'll never work. It certainly can't. Nuclear power cannot compete with renewable energy anymore. You can't, you know, a windmill is cheaper than a nuclear plant at this point, and there's more capacity. More wind power is being built on the planet today than nuclear is being built. So these guys, they have no economic room to maneuver anymore. There's no, in terms of the markets, you know, I'll take a free market in energy any day. I've become a Milton Friedman guy. I mean, you know, remove the subsidies from coal and oil and nukes and gas and go head-to-head with wind and solar and biofuels, and wind, solar, and biofuels win. You know, wind power is now down, even in Michigan, places in Michigan, it's down 5 cents a kilowatt hour. You can't beat that.
Sure.
And you know, you have Ovonics, you have all these solar cells being built, you have solar water heating. This is the next big dot-com, except it's not going to crash, because, well, unless people are completely nutso again. But, you know, there's a limitless future, virtually limitless future for renewable energy.
Well, Harvey Wasserman, just in the couple of minutes we have remaining, let's talk about some of the solutions that you suggest. And some of them, you're talking about market-driven, which is not usually my big advocation, but like you talk about increasing fuel efficiency standards with the price of gas, it's really happening. Ford, particularly, its SUVs and truck sales are dropping precipitously.
Yeah, and you know, Toyota, I think, just surpassed General Motors.
No, it just surpassed Ford.
As a Ford. Oh.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, I remember one years ago I heard Rush Limbaugh saying, don't listen to these liberals. What they want to do is take your SUVs away from you.
Well, America's greatest oxymoron,
I mean, you know, this has happened twice now. In the 1970s, remember, after the oil embargo, they said the same thing. And Ford and GM, and remember Chrysler, did nothing. And Honda and Toyota came in and, you know, stole their business. Now, once again, you know, we're talking about hybrids. And Ford and General Motors, no Chrysler at this point, you know, said, hey, forget it. And once again, they're getting clobbered. I mean, are we brain dead in this country? Don't answer that. I mean, you know, so the point is that renewables are not rocket science. There's no need for a Manhattan Project. This stuff has been invented. When I sat down to construct a solartopia, a world driven on green energy, to be 25 years out, I didn't have to invent anything.
Mm-hmm.
All the technology that we need to get to a green-powered Earth 100% is invented. Now, there's going to be some improvements, you know, in biofuels. Wind power, there will be some improvements, but, God, we're under 5 cents a kilowatt hour already. You know, there's not much deeper you can go. Biofuels are going to be improved, but, you know, we know what biofuels are about. Brazil is almost entirely out of petroleum economy at all. They're just using bagasse from sugarcane and other biofuels. I mean, Brazil's a big country. So this stuff is here. It's with us. And photovoltaic cells, where the United States had the lead worldwide, you know, it's all Sanyo, Sharp, Kyocera. But thankfully, Ovonix is in the picture too. So Solartopia, you know, it's not far. Not only is it not far-fetched, you get there with stuff that's already been invented,
mm-hmm.
and the jobs that could be created, and the economic benefits are just, you know, we should be doing this anyway, even if global warming wasn't a problem.
Well, one of your other solutions, actually, that wouldn't even be necessary if we made that switch, which is curbing carbon dioxide emissions, right?
Right.
Yeah. But even in the short run, as you know from your environmental activism, that the Great Lakes is supervised by a body called the International Joint Commission.
Right.
And long time ago, they said zero emissions into the Great Lakes, both air and water, and since they don't have any enforcement power, that's never happened. I mean, in a short run, we ought to be doing that at a minimum.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the Great Lakes themselves are a huge energy resource. If you look at the wind maps of the Great Lakes, if anybody's interested, go to nrel.us, nrel.us, and look at their wind maps. In Lake Erie and in the other lakes is red, which indicates class 7, which is the highest wind speed. And, you know, the lakes are shallow, they're fresh water. I mean, there's all this argument over wind farms going into the oceans. The oceans are the last place they should go. They should go in the lakes first because the lakes are fresh water. The ocean, you have a four-letter word problem there, which is salt. And, salt destroys a lot of machinery, whereas in the lakes, you have fresh water, they're shallow, the good sites are close to cities. You know, Toronto's got $90 million invested already in offshore windmills that they're being built. So city of Buffalo, every city in the lakes will have windmills right in the downtown area.
Well, you coined the phrase no nukes way back when. No oil, that's not very catchy, but that's what we ought to be looking at. Harvey Wasserman, thanks so much for being with me.
Well, thank you. I hope to see you in Solartopia.
Yes, and Solartopia, the name of Harvey Wasserman's book, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030, is the subtitle. You can go to harveywasserman.com. It'll also be on my website, peterwerby.com. I forgot. I'm just going to read this. Harvey Wasserman is the father of 5 daughters, but donates to zero population growth as penance. Harvey.
Right, I do it on a per capita basis.
Thanks for joining me.
Peter, you're the greatest. Thank you.
This is WRIM.com.
I've been good.
right, in 3, 2, 1. Back to the Riff Rocket 4 minutes or less. This is 101.
What?
101.
What'd you say?
101 WRIF.
That's what I thought.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
Yeah.
Skid Row, I Remember You, 101 WRIF Detroit. Slayer, Alan Beck stepping in, following Peter Werby and Julian Jordan with Night Call here on The Riff. And lots of stuff coming up this